Hey, everybody. Welcome to Chips and Tips Podcast. My name is Tim Paul. This is episode 4. We have Dylan Jackson on with us tonight, and I'm super excited to learn more about Dylan, learn everything there is to know about machining. So with that, I have some bullet points to kind of poke the conversation along, but could you give us a quick overview of who you are, what you do, and then I want to get into your history a little bit, and then we have some fun questions and stuff at the end.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Dylan Jackson. I am co-owner and operator of Protium Machining in Tucson, Arizona, and also host, producer, everything within Tolerance Podcast.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. So that's two. I kind of want to, there's a lot of questions, right? So we're going to kind of freestyle this, but I think I'll ask some questions along the way, but I want to understand how you got into within Tolerance. So let's make sure to circle back to that.
Okay.
But let's use the time machine a little bit and go back to, we have so many good stories in this industry, and I just love hearing them. You do an amazing job with Intolerance of sharing people's stories. Actually, when I was on your podcast, it was kind of made me like rethink and organize my thoughts. So let's start with you. Let's send it back to you. Flip the script. And how did you get interested in machining? How did you actually get into it? And then we'll poke it along from there.
Okay.
Go back as far as you want.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I've always been, you know, a Lego kid, build stuff. Like a key memory, I think, in third grade was we had a bunch of these broken RC cars, and over, I think, winter break, I took apart 3 or 4 of them and put them back together to something working, and was, you know, that was like the first, like, oh, I can make anything. Like, this is super cool. But machining specifically, I was going to the University of Arizona. I was just finishing up my second year, and the advisor brought me into his office and was like, so we're going to ask you not to come back next semester. You've been dicking around too much and your grades aren't good enough. So you need to go to the community college, Pima Community College here, and raise your GPA and kind of figure your shit out and, get your GPA up. And then you can come back and finish whenever you're there. And of course I was just like so crestfallen, and I knew I was not doing well. You know, I had like dynamics class at 7 a.m. It was like, I'm never going to that. And, you know, I was always the kid in high school, and all throughout my career up until that point, I'd always just kind of intuitively been able to listen to a little bit, read a little bit, and ace the test. And then college hit, and I had many teachers who spoke English kind of poorly as their second language. And on top of it, just content that actually required you to pay attention and study and go to office hours and all that. And I was more interested in going out and going to parties and hanging out with friends and stuff like that. So I went to Pima Community College, which turns out had a fantastic machining program, a machine tool technology program. Okay. And this through theme of being extremely naive in the things I think to myself will come up over and over again. But I was just looking for an elective. I was like, oh, I kind of know what machining is. Like, I think, and they had a 101 class that they said, like, oh, if you know all this stuff, you can test out and go into 102. I'm like, ah, I can do that. And then, of course, the first thing was like, how do you read a micrometer? I was like, what's a micrometer?
Ooh.
So I went into the 101, was taking, you know, high level math, physics, all that stuff at the same time. And slowly just really started to enjoy it. And I was like, oh, I'll stay through my manual machining certificate, which was a program that they did for, I think it was 1 year you could get that done.
Okay.
And I start getting towards the end of that. And I'm like, oh, what's this CNC stuff though? Like, that looks fun. And so I was like, oh, I'll stick out through they had some other like shortened program that was like CNC operator or something. I was like, oh, I'll stick out for that, you know, whatever. And thankfully, I had a fantastic teacher, Jay Deaver, who is still there and I think running the machining program right now. And he was a adjunct. So he was actively working in a shop, a prototype shop. And he was very good about recognizing that I wanted more. So like this was something I took to very quickly. Right. So like he would give us, it was all manual G code programming, and he'd give us the program to write. I'd be done in about 5 minutes and everybody else is working. And he'd be like, all right, if you're done, come over here and let's talk about speeds and feeds. Let's talk about this. Let's talk, how would you change the program to do this? And like really mentored me, through that. And yeah, I ended up sticking it out through the entire associates. And I think I want to say about halfway through the program, I had a really bad motorcycle accident and was out for an entire semester. And that kind of reshaped the way I looked at stuff. It was like, all right, I need to start taking things seriously. It can all be taken away from me in an instant.
Street bike or dirt bike?
Street bike. It was the only time I've ever had on any legal document from the cops, me going the speed limit and doing everything right. And some guy just T-boned me.
Okay. I've been there. Yeah, I know.
Yeah. It was a big Nissan Titan truck hit me. I remember two streets before, and then I remember waking up in the ambulance and them cutting my gear off. And it was like, oh, okay. And I was super lucky. I think I broke, you know, some small bones in my foot, some really bad gashes where like metal had torn me up. But like overall, I was wearing all my gear, lucked out, all that stuff. But I went back, and at the same time, you know, I'd moved home then because I just needed care and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Went back to school. And again, kind of naively, there was a shop in town that had a Craigslist ad for a MasterCam programmer. And I went in and said, well, I don't know MasterCam, but I'm going to learn it. Like Pima teaches MasterCam. I was like, I'm in classes for it. I will learn it eventually.
Yeah.
And they said like, well, we can't pay you, but you could work here. And so, you know, I thankfully had that time to do that. And so I swept floors and picked up chips and all that stuff for about a month. And then they had a maintenance guy leave and they were like, hey, there's a open paycheck if you want it. If you want to start doing more. I was like, sure. Okay.
Give me a rough profile of that shop.
They're a prototype shop as well. Lots of older Kitamuras. I think it was the machines ranged between 83 and 95. They were using MasterCam at the time. Lots of, you know, Tucson has lots of optics and then also aerospace because we have Raytheon here. Mm-hmm. So lots of work like that. And yeah,
rough
just kind
size,
of.
Size, rough people size, headcount.
I think at that point they were. Five or six of us. It's kind of bounced between like 4 to 8, I want to say, throughout the entire time I was there.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just kind of built my career there as I was going to school. Like I went from the guy who swept the floors to one of their programmers and was doing really well there. And things, they could tell I was, you know, not wanting to be there as much. And I don't think wanted me to be there as much. Like I kind of butted heads with their manual machine lead. He didn't like that I was this young kid coming in and you know, he'd see me on my phone and yell at me about being on my phone. I'm like, I've got three machines running and they're all making parts. Like, what are you talking about? Leave me alone.
Yeah.
That was what I heard the phrase from my boss. Sometimes the appearance of evil is worse than the evil. I was like, cool. Awesome. Yeah.
Okay, we're gonna pause. Parents of you, okay. I have a quote list that I keep a running quote list, so I had to scribble that down.
Awesome.
That's a good one. That's a good one.
Good. Yeah, I learned a lot there. I learned a lot about dealing with personalities that I didn't like and how to deal with that professionally. And my boss actually taught me a ton. Like he really took me by the hand and led me up through the ranks.
Good.
I remember the first part I programmed there. He let me get 3 or 4 ops into it before I like had kind of backed myself into a corner. And he was like, all right, let's start this over. You and I will program it together. We'll run it together on a machine.
That's a gift.
I still have that part somewhere. Like it's a reminder of like, man, sometimes you don't know everything and you need to kind of learn. So
yeah.
His other quote that I constantly repeat as we were looking towards hiring is one day I took a shell mill and ran it into some hard jaws because it was before I'd really wrapped my head around height offsets. And so I had, these were hardened jaws that had little rails you could replace with aluminum to use them as like faux soft jaws. And I had cut the step with the face mill and then just left the face mode there and then set zero, you know, reference zero for my G54, not remembering that there's also a height offset in there. Loaded my part, hit go, it comes down below the part, and then
some face mill size depth below the part.
Yeah. And so I took it, you know, immediately up to him, and I was like, I'm so sorry, blah, blah, blah. And the thing he would always say to me is, will you hurry up and fuck up so I can start trusting you?
Ooh.
And because he's like, you're going to make mistakes. Oh, I know you're going to make mistakes. Just get them out of the way. Like, make them. Well, what's funny is recently I told him this and he just laughed and laughed. He's like, that was something that one of my old mentors told me, and I don't even remember saying it to you. And I was like, that's been such a pivotal thing in my career.
I just wrote both of those down. That's good.
Yeah. So I was there for 2 or 3 years, I think, while finishing up at Pima.
Okay.
And then I went to another shop, and that one was a real good lesson in what not to do in a shop.
Okay.
They were
I want to get to that. So you're there 2 or 3 years and you were doing how many hours a week do you think you were doing while you were also going to Pima?
By the end I was 40-hour week full-time employee. Yeah.
Cool.
So you're doing a lot of night classes, night classes. Yeah.
Cool. All right. Now on to the next place. What not to do. So
the next place no longer exists. I was there for maybe 3 or 4 months, after I had been pushed into contract programming for my first job, because that was how they kind of soft transitioned me out of the company. I was like, I don't even know if I want to do this anymore. Like, I'm kind of just sick of it. And so kind of bounced around. I did some like contract programming for some friend shops and, you know, tried to make that work. And I just didn't have the motivation at that point to really scrounge up business. And so I started working at this shop night shift, which is something I'd never done and will probably never do again if I can help it. It's not healthy. But this was the kind of shop
person that thrives there.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's not me. Like ours was not even overnight. It was 2 to 11 or 2 to midnight or something like that. And it was rough. It was just not fun.
Vampire job.
Yeah. Yeah. And this shop was the kind of shop where, oh, we've got some end mill somewhere for that. Like, I remember the story I always tell about this place is they gave me 80 of these, I think they were 4140 bodies that were like low 50 Rockwell. And I think I ordered like $80 worth of AccuPro tools because I knew they were so stingy, and they jumped down my throat about it. Like, they had 80 of these to make. And they were like, just go grab something out of the bin. Like, what are you talking? I'm like, really? Like, and these were tight tolerance, you know, aerospace parts. And yeah, I knew
total top shelf end mills for it.
Yep. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was like, oh, I'm going to save them money and it's okay. I'll make do. I'll figure it out. Like I had to turn on high speed machining on all their Haas controls. Like they didn't know that option existed, and they were doing this crazy surfacing job. And I turned it on and saved them 30, 45 minutes apart, and then they still didn't buy it. They're like, well, we got through the job, so that's good enough. It's like, guys, come on.
I've run into that so many times as part of Autodesk. Try to help. You know, I did a lot of helping people. It's like, yeah, this is worth it. Trust me. Here's your free time. Make sure you learn how to appreciate it before it runs out.
Yeah, like I said, it was a great lesson in the what not to do. Like, especially at that point, I'd already had my own shop. So I guess backing up, I started Protium in my last year at my first job. And that happened, these stories were kind of going on at the same time. So I met Brad, my business partner, in school at Pima. We both rode motorcycles. We both were big into cars, sat next to each other, became friends, kind of. Both were incredibly naive and thinking like, I can do it so much better than my bosses can. Like, they don't know what they're doing. Like, I'd be so much of a better business owner. And just lamenting about that all the time, kind of joked like, you know, we could buy a machine, like, and you know, start something. And it was much more of a joke until there was a robo drill in Phoenix that had lost all its parameters. And I'm like, I've put parameters back in many Kitamuras. I've done a lot of the maintenance. I know how to do this.
Yeah.
And he was like, all right, let's get it. And then we called on it and it was gone. And we were both so crestfallen. We're like, all right, there's something here. Like, we should start mm-hmm. something. And cool. Lucked out, found this old Kitamura that a shop in town was letting go. They were like an all Haas shop and had one Kitamura that was like the real oddball. They wanted to get rid of it. We got it for a great price, bought it before we even had a shop space for it, and then wow. just kind of slapped it all together as quickly as we could.
What controls on a Kitamura?
That one was a Yaznek J300. Well, it was okay. a weird oddball one. It was a Yaznek. Okay. It booted and said I80. But then it turned out it was J300 control hardware, and Kitamura had this weird gap year where, like, they were putting the older software on the newer hardware, and yeah, we learned a lot okay. about that machine.
Okay.
it was a great machine, though. Like, it far outperformed many modern control machines that I've run before.
Okay.
And it was, you know, a 15,000-pound BT30 little palette changer. Like, it was great.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. So you were you basically worked into mostly programming at the first shop. Does that sound right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep.
And then you were there 2 or 3 years. The last year you started Protium?
I think it was the last year. Last kind year, year and a half, window. Something like yeah. that. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And now's probably a good time to get to one of my questions is, Tell us the story about the name behind Protium.
So I actually have a book somewhere, like a notepad book that I was going through logos and ideas. And, you know, we're like, oh, do we do the whole, like, you know, first letter of your last name initial thing? Mm-hmm, like, how mm-hmm. do you do it? Yeah. And then we're like, oh, yeah. what kind of work do we want to do? Prototyping. And so we're playing on that. And Proteus is the Greek god of mutability and quick change. And so
ooh,
I struck on that. Like, I was like, oh, I got on like the Greek roots and started looking at Greek gods and all this stuff. And
yeah.
so I found that and I was like, well, maybe if we, you know, change the lettering a little bit, Protium, that sounds yeah. good. Like that, we can do something with that.
I like it. I like it. I like when there's a story behind it. My buddy Derek. He's a general manager for Trinity, the Palette Systems. He and I are always like talking about names of companies and kind of what's behind them. So that's good. I was hoping there was a story and it wasn't some random. I almost Googled it before we hopped on. And I was like, I hope there's a decent story there. So. Okay. So you are about a year or so out of your first shop,
mm-hmm.
And then you jumped into another shop, and that wasn't going awesome.
Yeah,
and there's a big terrible. Next. What's next after that?
So to finish that story up, I was yeah. there. They could tell that I was far outperforming all of their programmers and setup people. They had not hired me as a programmer. They hired me as a setup person, and then I was showing them all this stuff and, you know, showing them that I knew all this stuff, and they're like, oh, okay, you know, maybe we'll move you into programming. They did that for a little bit. Are you familiar with Mastercam at all?
I used it for quite a few years, yeah.
Okay, so you know, like, the yeah. WCS manager and how, like, that's how you turn on different WCSs, and so you can simulate multiple ops.
Yeah.
The other two
yeah.
guys didn't even know that. Like, they would just move the part. Like copies of the part. And then, so like at one yes. point, I remember I programmed something on night shift and one of the guys calls me and he goes, dude, where is your part? Like, why can't I simulate op two? I'm like, what are you talking about? And then I get in there that next day and I'm like, you just do this. And they're like, oh, I had no idea that existed. Like, I've never been in that window before. Like, this is day one stuff in Mastercam. What are you talking about?
You're bringing back some memories. So my first job at Autodesk was a sales applications for HSMWorks.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go into a Mastercam shop and somebody would be like, I can't do this in Mastercam. Can Fusion or HSM do that? And I was always like biting my tongue. I was like, should I just show them how to do it in Mastercam?
Uh-huh.
Or should I just move along? And I kind of honestly had like some guilt feelings quite a bit when I was like selling them HSM. knowing that like they could just do it in Mastercam.
Right. That their main gripe was something that was very easily done.
Not hard. Yeah. I mean, not awesome either, but also hard. Right. Yeah.
No, but by far not great, but
I got over it. I got over it. So, don't mean to keep interrupting. So, so you're teaching them some stuff. I was going to ask, you said you're outperforming, their guys. So by what measure? That would be a good measure, right?
Yeah.
Knew their tools better than them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Keep going. And then I downloaded, I think, a 30-day trial of Inventor Cam because we were doing, you know, government work, like defense stuff. Yeah. And so we couldn't do Fusion at that point. Like I was using Fusion in my shop. I knew how good it was.
Give me a rough year.
Couldn't bring it in.
Give me a rough year.
This was 2018, 2019.
Oh, wow. Like. Okay.
No. Let's see. I'm trying to think of when 2015.
Okay.
I think.
That's when I started on it. So Fusion was very new. Inventor HSM, Inventor Cam was still being called Inventor Cam, kind of in there. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So to back it
just
up a little
bit. Aligning this with my life. Yeah.
Yeah. So that first shop I worked in, I convinced them to buy licenses of Fusion. And it was early enough in Fusion's thing that Kurt Chan flew out from California and trained us for 3 or 4 days.
Wow. That's amazing.
So that was back when they were doing the hard sell. And they were like, oh, you'll buy 3 licenses? Yeah, we'll fly somebody out to train you.
Early. So that would have been like 15-ish. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So back to that shop, I downloaded Inventor Cam, found a post for a Haas. Like this was an all Haas shop. Yeah. Was immediately up and running and making parts with it, and they were like stoked on it.
So
they thought they couldn't believe that happened and how much quicker it was, and you know the adaptive was so much better. I think we're using like X4 or something like that at that shop, so it wasn't like even the newest of anything. Yeah. And then I was just still really unhappy. And so I ended up, it's the only time I've ever even considered dealing with a recruiter. And I went to a recruiting agency in town and was just like, I need a job. I need another machining job. Like none of the ones that I've looked at have looked great. You know, find me a place. This is what my resume is. And
no kidding.
They proceeded to find me an interview at a place and then completely lie about what they were looking for. They were like, oh, yeah, they're looking for a Fusion programmer who can program and set up and yada, yada, yada. And I go there and get into the interview, and they're like, what's Fusion? What are you talking about? We're looking for a quality person or a button pusher. And I was like, oh, okay.
Oh.
But I was so miserable. And they were paying more, like for a quality position, they were paying more than I was making as a quote-unquote programmer at this other shop.
You have a rough percentage? Right. You have a rough percentage? How much more?
I mean, it was like $3 or $4 more an hour.
Okay.
Like, it was significant.
Okay. That's about,
And so I told my bosses, I was like, I'm leaving. And they're like, no. Like, what do you need to stay? And I was like, you need to buy... I was like, you need to raise my pay to this. You need to buy Inventor Cam immediately because I don't want to work on Master Cam anymore. And you need to stop fighting me on all these tooling decisions and stuff. Like, and they're like, oh, yeah, and we'll make you head programmer and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, put it in writing. I'll be back tomorrow. I'll put it in writing. I got back in the next day and they were like, well, we can't quite make you head programmer. And, you know, you wanted this, but we can give you a couple bucks less an hour than that. And we'll see you about Inventor. And I was like, I'm gone. Deuces, like we're done. I'll see you later. And
you did have an offer at the other place.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I already had a job there and
nothing
I was
like an offer to give you some confidence to leave.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean that's why I told them. I was like, these are, you know, I don't want to like put it as these are my demands, but like you want me here. This is what I need to continue working here, otherwise I'm out of here. And like thank goodness I left because I think they were gone in 6 or 8 months after that, something like that. So
tell me about quality. That's an interesting one. What was your, so you were hired to do exactly roughly what quality and
just a quality guy. I mean, just a QC, like thread
what
checks.
What was your background in this before?
I knew how to use a mic. I made parts. Like
they
knew that I knew how to do this stuff. Like I was able to communicate that in the interview. I know how to do all this stuff. I am a self-starter. I can do all this. And one thing I think that kind of made me look better than a lot of the other interviewees is that the first shop I worked in had the exact same manual CMM as that they had two of in quality. Yeah. And I was like, I know how to run those. I've run those for years. No problem.
I can bang that around parts.
Yep. And so they were like, okay, great.
And what kind of CMM?
They're Gage 2000s from Brown and Sharp. It's like the last, I mean, I guess they became like Tessa 3Ds or something like that when they got bought out, but it's a really good manual seat. Like I have got one in my shop right now.
Oh, you did?
Because, we that's another crazy story that we lucked out on. But so I started
I'll
the shop.
That down for later.
So this shop was unlike anything I'd ever done. They had real processes. They were aerospace and defense production, but in like a small batch production. So we would do 20 to 50 of one, and then 2 months later, do another 20 to 50 and constantly turning over stuff like that. And they had 20 or 30 employees around that. Very tight-knit, family-owned shop. Treated us incredibly well.
Okay.
And started as quality, kind of showed some interest in programming their auto CMM. And so their one guy who knew how to program it started teaching me stuff. And very quickly, I took over for him as the guy who was programming the auto CMM. And then they started sending me to training for the auto CMM. And I became that was my job first. Like it was first get programs updated and done right in the in PC Demis, and then do thread checks, do dips, all that stuff, detailed inspection plans for because we would do lot sampling and all that stuff. Like that's where I really learned AS and ISO and what goes into it, and how to fill out a fare and it.
What a process!
I say very often that like working in quality made me a better machinist than the previous 100%. However many years.
100%.
Because like that, I also worked directly with our final inspector, and he was the most meticulous guy ever. Like he would find the tiniest hair burr that you left on a thread out of 100 threads in the part. Like he would no problem find it. Like. And I learned how to touch up parts too. Like, take these stones, take these sanding sticks, take this Scotch-Brite, and like we can fix this. It was fantastic.
Your quality guy, the guy that was kind of mentoring you in quality, was showing you how to not just reject parts.
Oh yeah, all the people there were incredibly skilled at that. Like they,
good.
Because the first thing that this shop does too is that I think your first 2 months or so.
Yeah.
You're working in deburring. You're working as a button pusher. You're, spending a little bit of time in engineering. You get to see everything in the company. And most of the people in quality had worked in one of these other places too. So like one of my friends, Knott, who worked in there, he was one of their long time inspectors, but he was in deburring for the longest time. And so like they all knew exactly how to fix those parts.
So many or most of the people or all of the people, they've kind of shuffled through different departments at least a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. If you were hired there, you at least had a couple weeks in every department.
What a smart thing to do. If anybody's listening with a notepad, write that one down. First shop I worked at, I broke my femur. I used to race mountain bikes. And my get back to work plan was sit in a rolling chair and work in QC for, I don't even remember how long, under a really smart QC guy. He actually had the opposite. Like he was that salty QC guy that would like look to reject parts, not look to accept parts. Right. But I reflect back 100 times, 1,000 times, thousands of times. Like, it's just made me so much better of a machinist. So it sounds like the place you were at, I mean, that's just like took that to a whole nother level. And everybody actually wanted to work together to make good parts, not reject parts.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, a lot of these had many outside processes. They had, you know, weeks of internal operations, and it mattered. It really mattered. Actually, as a side story too. So the inspector at my first job and I did not get along. He thought I was, you know, I didn't spend enough time deburring stuff. I didn't do enough on the machine. I was lazy about it, blah, blah, blah. I hated him. He hated me. It turns out he had come from this last shop that I worked in. So he was there.
Right.
And I still thank him to this day for being as hard as he was on me, because he was right. I was lazy and I was not deburring things correctly and I didn't know what I was doing. And once I had that full circle of being back in quality, I saw how much that meant, because if it wasn't deburred properly, it meant that the ladies in deburring had to spend an extra hour on that part. And it could have been 5 minutes in the cycle and done, and they never would have had to touch it. So I learned a lot, and it was a very interesting full circle moment when I was like, oh, damn it, David's right. He was 100% right.
It's funny how life works. If you're honest enough with yourself to be able to look back at that, it's funny how that works.
Yeah.
Okay. So I want to hear more about this position, but let's pause for a second and tie in Protium from, so what was happening at Protium between your first place, the intern place, and then this place?
So it started becoming really real when I got to this most recent place. Like we started growing a lot more, started having a lot more work. And it started being starting looking like a real company. Like, you know, both Brad and I saw it as like, oh, you know what? We could actually go full time. Like this could actually work. And so that, I affectionately called it my other 40 hours of the week job. And so I would work all day at my day job and then either go home and go to the gym for a little bit or go straight there and work for 5, 8, 10 hours. I remember there was a couple of nights where I worked overnight at my shop and then went straight back to work. And it was, it sucked. I wasn't good at my job the second day, but
it's a common trend in our industry. It's real, like, self care, healthy kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. We're all great at it.
Okay. So, where was most of your early work coming from, and then kind of the work for Protium, the jobs, not jobs, the work you're making at Protium, was that coming from?
We started out with a few local customers that were just friends of friends. You know, we put up like a Facebook post like, hey, we started something on the side if you got any work. We were doing a lot of aircraft plates. Like they were, I think this company made stuff for like Bombardier and companies like that. And so they would give us laser cut plates and bent, and then we'd have to make fixtures and put in like the tight tolerance features for them. And it was really nice because at the very beginning, it wasn't even like, hey, quote this. It was like, hey, we have this many plates for you to pick up and this is what we can pay for it. I was like, okay.
Right.
And like,
dream.
You either say yes or no. Yeah.
It's a dream for a young shop.
Especially, and especially when we were doing it part-time, you know, it was just enough work that we could work like 1 or 2 days a week and maybe a weekend day and make enough to pay our rent and electricity and, you know, maybe buy a couple new tools that month kind of thing.
Awesome.
And then we just started, you know, finding more local customers, some more customers out of state through word of mouth, and it just kind of kept going from there.
Good. What was Brad? So you met Brad at, I already forgot the name of the school.
Pima.
Pima. So you met Brad at Pima, right? And what was Brad doing for work?
So Brad, we had very complementary set of skills. So I was doing prototyping, rapid stuff. He worked at a company in town that makes their own product, production. He was night shift lead, I think, at that point. And they would make 1,000 of something. And like at that point I had done almost only aluminum. And at that point he had done almost only stainless steel. Like all of their stuff is 316 and 304. And, So we balance each other out. Like, if I learned a lot from him, he learned a lot from me, and it continues that way very much.
Good. Good.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. So now you're at the third place. Protium's kind of a fun little, good little happy place. And then what?
So they recognize that, you know, I had more skills than QC. And so then I started getting kind of dragged into an engineering role, a manufacturing engineering role, because they were like, oh, he can program, he can do this. Like, and so it was kind of this fight between my boss in quality and the boss in engineering of like, oh, I need Dylan to do this. It was like, well, no, but I need him to do this too. And so I was still programming the CMM, still helping out in quality when I could. But I was also troubleshooting things on the floor. A big part of the engineering job there is just maintaining programs and changing them if we need to. You know, if we find new tooling to make things better, it's also kind of walking that fine line of like, what changes can we make without triggering a process evaluation from our customers? And it was a lot. I learned a lot at that point. It was tough to find like that line of where you can change something without triggering a evaluation of the process for the customer. You know, a lot of these were frozen processes.
Yeah.
It was troubleshooting stuff, figuring out tool replacements when things were phased out. You know, a lot of these programs have been running for 20 years, something like that. Yeah. And so like they might have a custom form tool that no longer exists and we don't have a drawing for. And so like I'd either make a drawing for it or replace it with a few tools to make that feature. It was a lot, and it was great though. And at the same time, I was still learning how to program the auto CMM better. I was the one who picked out our second auto CMM with scanning, and then went to level 2 training in California for that.
Where in California?
Irvine. Yeah. And
how did you get into, I assume, you picked up some GD&T along the way, and tell me about that journey. I don't think enough people commit to this in our trade or a lot of our whole education system. This is deeply passionate. If anybody watching, I have this GD&T poster from, I think, the person that explains GD&T better than anybody, Dr. Hetfield. I don't think our education system puts enough into this. You can be a mechanical engineer and have like a real brief overview. It's, to me, that's like the language of our industry. I think very often machinists kind of learn it better than engineers just through like having to deliver good parts. So I love to understand your journey of learning some GD&T and all that stuff.
Working in quality, especially when you're dealing with aerospace parts, like they're all using GD&T. I learned both the correct way from the books that, you know, the resources I was given, and then also saw many applications of incorrect GD&T because of that. And I've been a big supporter of that as well. I completely agree. It is the language of our trade. And I think, I don't even know how many years ago it was now, but I went and got ASME GD&T certified at the senior level because I firmly believe that. Like, I think that that's, you need to know what you're doing.
Where did you do that?
I did that just privately. I bought the standard, studied that. Yeah. I went and did the GD&T course through GD&T Basics. They have like a three course series you can buy. And between that and setting the standard and studying a couple other books, I was able to pass, which was great.
Awesome. Awesome. It's something I decided to care about a long time ago. Honestly, I was working for myself, felt like I needed a job, went and applied somewhere, and I bombed some GD&T questions and was like, never again. Unfortunately, if I had to go get a job, I would probably fail now, but,
Yeah, it's tough. It's still tough for me. Like, I still have to reference the standard and stuff every now and again. You get some weird profile tolerance that you're not quite familiar with, and you're like, I got to go look. Or, you know, composite tolerance, and you're like, does it apply how I think it's going to apply?
Yeah.
So it's still something I need to reference.
I think that's good to talk about. And I'm dragging the JD&T stuff out because I think it is really important. A couple of themes here, like both of us basically took the education on ourselves, right? It sounds like we did. I took it as something I had to own. And I think too many people, our industry has like people that are just like, I'll go figure it out myself. I'll kind of own my own education. And then the other part of our industry, you know, there's people that like, yeah, I'm happy to learn it if somebody teaches me, you know, if somebody pays me to go to train, whatever. And I think some of the most biggest, I didn't take on education, didn't take on English, but the most biggest lessons I've had, most biggest opportunities I've had were because I like invested in my own education, right? And it sounds like that's aligned with you. So
100%. Yeah. But to all those employers out there, I think the GD&T class was like $400 or $500.
Yeah.
And like whenever we hire somebody, immediately I'm going to buy it for them. Or once they show an aptitude for it, like it's just a no-brainer. Like have them pass it. I think you get access to the data for a year or something like that. And it's just so vital in our industry. Sure. And really I got certified because I was dealing with so much of it. Thankfully we deal with a lot of great engineers at Protium, but
occasionally,
you know, you have to have that conversation of like, do you really mean this? Like, do you know what you're asking for here? Because it's the difference between like $1,000 part and a $10,000 part.
Yeah. So what I'll share on top of that is, what you just hit on is super important. Is I think a lot of people are like, I don't know, I'm just a machinist. And my point earlier was a lot of machinists understand the concepts, you know, better than a lot of the engineers. And to give the engineers credit, I, in the last few years, a couple of years at Autodesk, I've worked with engineering students. You know, I worked in education. A good engineering school goes pretty deep, and a bad engineering school doesn't. You know, they care about more fluid dynamics and stuff like that. So a lot of engineers just have this real surface level, you know, overview of it. And I think my takeaway from what you just said was like, have some confidence to have, you know, careful conversations, right, with your customers. Mm-hmm. I worked at a big aerospace company. I'll go nameless on that one. And there was like pretty often conflicting GD&T stuff that like literally would back you into a corner. I can't deliver on everything you're asking for. And so many times, like I lack confidence sometimes. You know, I always feel like the dumbest guy in the room. Like I'm smart enough to know that I'm not, but I think we talked about this on the podcast with you. Like I have this imposter syndrome, and when I got to go talk to like some VP of engineering at NASA about their garbage they're giving you, take the time, make sure you understand. And if you navigate it cautiously, very often it'll turn into just wonderful relationships, right?
Oh, yeah. You got to phrase it in the way where it's not, hey, idiot, you're doing this. It is like, hey, I want to save you money, or I want to save you time, or whatever is most precious to your customer. Like, hey, let's work together to get you what you want kind of thing.
Yeah, I want to make sure I understand your intent here. That was a often opening line for me. So any younger machinist or any machinist, that's a real important lesson that I'm glad we talked about. How? So you feel like you found a spot where like you're not having as many of those conversations now that you used to because of the customers you have? Or
I would say a lot of the customers that we work with, we don't get a lot of prints right now. They want parts so quickly that it's just like, hey, here's a model, here's a blanket tolerance, I want it yesterday, can you make it? We have a lot, like they rely on my knowledge and Brad's knowledge of like, hey, I think this is how it assembles. I think this is what it does. I'm going to focus on like making this flat. And I think that this is how it's going to go together. And granted, like the blanket tolerances are pretty small. Like we have to make pretty perfect parts, but it's true rapid prototyping.
Congratulations on those relationships. Yeah, because very often, especially aerospace, like my experience, when they wanted something quick, they would just tighten up everything because they didn't have time to like think through it, right? If they can trust your understanding of the intent or even have a verbal conversation of what the design intent is, that's wonderful. So my takeaway there is make sure you have good relationships with your customers.
Yeah. Awesome. Think that's something I sent Chris like a YouTube short the other day that was some guy saying, you know, the only competitive advantage you have in any business is your relationships. Like someone is always going to do it better, faster, cheaper, whatever. Literally the only thing you can ever rely on being your competitive advantage is your relationships with them. And so like, that's something that we really focus on at Protium is I'll hold somebody's hand through the entire process if I have to, and if they want to, and I love that collaborative nature.
Yeah. It's selfishly to pay the bills for Toolpath. I mean, that's kind of our shtick at Toolpath, right? Is, you know, Al, when he became the CEO, I was one of, I think, his first hires after that. My focus is exactly what you just said, was like, we're here to build, you know, community and relationships around Toolpath. I mean, our job is to build, you know, the best software for what we're doing, but we see an equal value in having, you know, good, strong, supportive relationships with our customers. So, If I didn't focus on that my whole career, I'd still be back at the remain nameless first sweatshop I worked at.
So, right. Oh yeah.
That's awesome. So let's get back to your story. So you're in QC, you're getting more into manufacturing engineering type work. I cut in with some of the GD&T conversation. Mm-hmm. Protium's still popping off and doing well. And then what? And then what?
So the kind of the end of my career there, like they pulled me basically fully into engineering. My only QC responsibility still was programming the auto CMM because I was the one who, I mean, that was my baby. Like I was really the only one who could program the scanning CMM. I'm the only one who had ever programmed a part from CAD. Like when I first got there, that for the most part, they were programming them manually and like touching points on the model, creating a manual alignment, and then touching points on the model manually with the joystick and then creating programs that way. And like I was like, that's not how we're going to do this.
Good for you.
I've run CAM before. I know how to do this. So,
good for you.
And so like I continued to do that. I created all the template files and stuff, figured out all the standardized probing, things like that. And then, you know, it started becoming very clear that like Protium was doing really well and that one of us needed to be there full time. And Brad was just coming up, I think, on almost 10 years at his job and didn't want to leave before then. And I have a close friend who's in Chicago who runs a commercial LED lighting company, and he's been kind of a business mentor for years now. And I think it was maybe the December before I left, he called me up out of the blue. I was at Protium at night, you know, making parts. And he was like, what do you need to feel good to go full time? I was like, I don't really know. Like, I you know, it's a big step and blah, blah, blah. And he was like, you know, is it like 4 months of expenses? And I was like, I don't know. Maybe like that would help. Sure. And he was like, I'll give it to you right now if you quit
Damn
today.
It.
And I was like, I'm not going to do that, but like, I understand your point. Like I was like, I can't do that right now. Like I can't quit today. But it started that mental path, you know?
Yeah.
And then the next year, so I left in November of 2021, I believe. And I gave them 6 months notice, which in retrospect was about 5 months and 2 weeks more than I probably should have given. Or at least maybe like 5 months more. I gave him 6 months. What was funny is when I first got hired there, I told them up front, I was like, hey, I've got a shop on the side. We're not doing aerospace work. I think that they were like, yeah, whatever, your little garage shop, but we don't care. And then, so when I, you know, had a meeting with them and was like, hey, I'm leaving for my shop to go full time, I think it kind of clicked and was like, oh, okay. I guess it wasn't this little you know, hobby garage shop.
What had the conversations about it been during that whole time?
It had never been brought up.
Just never been brought up.
4.5 years I was there.
Okay.
Yeah. It was, just never even brought up, at least not to me. And as far as I know, through most of that time, I had the podcast as well. I think I started the podcast maybe a year or two into working there. And nobody listened to it. I was always worried that somebody was going to listen and find out. And it wasn't like I hadn't been open about any of this stuff, but it was still going to be a weird, awkward conversation if anybody had brought it up. But nobody ever said anything until I decided to leave.
Super interesting. That was on my list of things to talk about, timeline wise. Let's get it out of the way because it's already in parallel. So you're running three things in parallel. That's this third shop.
Yep.
Yeah. That's a story. That sounds. I'm running some parallels between your life and my life.
I always find that, you don't find time to do something. You just have to do it. And then you find the time, if you really want to do something
yes and figure it out. Yeah.
Yeah. You find that 25th hour in the day. If you just throw more stuff on your plate, it's just how it is. Yeah. I think maybe 2 years into working there, 2 or 3 years, something like that. Peyton, who runs Brick Tactical, reached out to me. Mm-hmm. The bomb was doing well then. People really liked it, but there was basically that and making chips, I think, at that point. Mm-hmm. There really wasn't a bunch of manufacturing podcasts. Maybe there was a few other odds and ends ones, but nothing really mainstream. Yeah. And he reached out and was just like, hey, do you want to do a podcast together? I think it would be fun. I was like,
oh, interesting. Okay.
Sure. I don't know what it'll look like, but sure. Why not? I'll find time. Not a problem. we just, we came up with a name and a logo and all that stuff and then just started doing it.
And I think your background in QC, it explains the name. You said it was Peyton. So you were doing it together with Peyton. So this is before I didn't listen. So you did it with Peyton originally.
Yeah. For about a year and a half. I think he left right around episode 75.
Okay. So I had, we chatted about me doing an episode. And I wasn't a big podcaster at the time. And I'm like, man, podcast. That's literally I don't got time for this shit. And it was but I like to do my homework. So I think I may have listened to the first one. I listened to a couple that he was on. Flipped through people I knew, Tita Ken, Al, CJ, some of those people. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, okay, this could be fun. I guess I'll wrap that part up with just seriously, super kudos to you. I think you probably had a bigger impact on the industry than maybe we haven't really talked about your assumptions of the impact you've had, but, I bet you've had a bigger impact on the industry than you know you have. I think more people need to hear other people's stories. And I think you've done a really good job with that. So kudos.
Thank
kudos
you so much.
You on that. Yeah.
It's still so weird to me that it has reached as many people as it has, because it still very much feels like, oh, I'm just, hanging out with some friends and does anybody listen to this kind of thing? I appreciate it.
Yeah. So, and to reinforce some stuff. So, I don't think you do any paid anything. Does that sound right?
Nope. I've got a Patreon for the show so that I can afford sending out mic kits and stuff like that to the guests. And
I think it feels very honest that way. I think a lot of the essence of the goodness comes from that. When we started this one for Toolpath, I mean, we're Toolpathers. We hope people love Toolpath because we're lovable. But it started off hey, people want to get to know us better. Let's do something, see where it goes. Honestly, we're fourth episode. So I was like, Dylan's pretty lovable. Let's have him on. But we're still figuring out where this is going. And yeah, I just think more people in the industry need to hear other people's stories. So especially when you talk about in the episode I was on there with you, we kind of unsurfaced. I don't know. We discovered some of my like imposter syndrome kind of stuff, right?
Which I know is so prevalent in the industry. I mean, I think that we all suffer from a little bit of that.
I had so many, so I felt insecure talking about it, right? Like it was such a weird thing. And then I had so many people ping me on Instagram afterwards saying, dude, like I always feel like I'm at the edge of like people realizing I'm a fake or whatever. And it was really meaningful to me to be like, oh, okay. So I shared my story and other people feel more confident that we're all just banging around trying to figure it out, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, and not only that, but so one of the questions was from Lone Wolf Precision. I was just telling him last night, like,
yeah,
not only is it imposter syndrome, but a lot of it is survivorship bias. It's like, just because it worked for me does not mean it'll work. Like I was the right place, the right time.
Yeah.
It was a 2:30 on a Friday when this happened to me and like it just worked out. But like I cannot, you know, I can tell you why I like stuff. I can tell you the stuff that worked for me, but like in no way am I saying like I'm a guru who knew that this plan was going to work from the get-go. Like in no way has any decision I've made in the business or in my life been like, oh, yeah, I can see the clear road for the next 5 years and this is exactly the step I need to take.
Some people might be out there. There might be some of those people out there, but I had a pretty special time at Autodesk for 10 years. And I think the most special part of that for me, it's like I literally got to travel the world, visiting other people's shops and going out to dinner with them, having a beer with them. And I just remember so many times being like, oh, we're totally different people and kind of the same, right?
Yep.
It's crazy rewarding for me. When I started in the industry, I just remember like, I got so much I got to learn before I can be a machinist. And I just had a few people like, just got to, you know, I was probably asking, like, how do you know the perfect chip load or whatever the answer, you know, the question was. And he's like, I had a couple old man Frank. You'll hear me talk about old man Frank. And I'm referring to like three older people. one of them was old man Frank. He's just like, you got to start somewhere and figure it out from there.
Yeah.
So awesome. Okay. So you went to them and was basically like, hey, it's time to leave. Mm-hmm. And give me a year, or even a month and year. I was following your journey when this happened. So when did that happen?
So I left in November of 2021. That was November 1st was my first day full-time at Protium. And yeah, I gave them 6 months. I thought I was being very generous trying to help them out. And, you know, I love all the people there. We still have a great relationship. They waited until like the last 3 weeks I was there to be like, oh, you need to document this, this, and this. And I was like, you got 3 weeks. I'll do as much as I can.
Yeah.
Like I'm out at November 1st. Like that's the deal. Cool. Yeah.
So, I would recommend against a 6 month notice, to anybody who's listening. I have a very, very strong instinct of like, I'll do whatever it takes, you know, to make sure this is a smooth transition. One time in one of my resignation letters, I wrote, this will be my last day or, as soon as possible or something along those lines. And my boss was like, oh, that's really good. He's like, you know what? Honestly, I think most people should leave as soon as possible. And he's like, when do you want to leave? And I was like, just want to make sure nothing's like screwing anybody. And he's like, oh, right. I love it. And he's like, let's sit down, go back to work. We'll sit down. We'll figure out what's going to screw people. And I left, you know, a week later or something like that. I've been a part of some long transitions, when I had my own business, when I was firing someone as a customer, they've never gone wonderfully. Even if you
and it wasn't terrible,
right?
Yeah. Like, yeah. I still love all the people there. I was very like, I burned no bridges by doing that. And I accomplished Good. Still quite a bit in that last 6 months. Like, I spun up a magnesium hogout project, and as far as I know, that part number is still running with almost zero issues to this
Nothing's
day,
burned.
Which is
the building has
almost unheard of. Nope. Yeah. Perfect. Learned a lot with that one, and I made some good template files that I hopefully are still working for the CMM. Like, they worked for like 100 parts under me, so I don't know why they wouldn't work, but if they're not, then you know, it is what it is. But that was a big learning lesson as well, of just like, you know, I tried to do what I thought was best for everyone, and it just wasn't, I don't think.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay, so now you're full-time Protium, and it's just you. What was the transition with you and Brad? Kind of remind everybody of that.
I went
transition's probably the wrong wording, but you probably understand where I'm going with that, right?
As far as like work,
Brad's still working somewhere else. Yeah, Brad, you were the first one to go full-time, right? And is he full-time now?
He's full-time now. He went, so I went in November. He went in like June of the next year.
Yeah.
And so, I felt like that was maybe a little premature at the time. I was just so worried that, like, you know, everything was working out. We were doing great.
Yeah.
Totally able to afford my salary. Not a problem. But there was still that, like, but what if everything, you know, goes to shit kind of thing. And I'm just so... When I take risks, I like it to be very measured, and I like it to be very researched, and something like that
Imagine
is much more akin to jumping into the abyss. I know, right, and like, going full-time is like jumping into the abyss. It's not like something you can really measure out. Like, you can do all the math you want, and something could, you know, shit could still hit the fan. So, he was like champing at the bit, really. Like, the second that I went full-time...
Yeah.
You know, I think we went through Christmas and the New Year's, and he was like, all right, when can I go full time? I was like, I don't know, a couple more months. Like, let's just feel it out. And I was like, he's like, man, I hit my 10 years. Like, I'm ready to get out of here. Like,
it's your time.
And yeah. And so,
okay. So you were November. June. You were November, and he was June. Mm-hmm. And how was it during that time? And so, okay. So you have a leased spot, your first leased spot.
Yeah, okay. So we were in our first lease spot all the way up until last February. So we were there for 8 years, something like that.
And then 8 years. Well, okay, so November of what year are we talking?
That we started the company?
That you started. No, sorry.
2021 was when I went full-time. So it'll be 4 years this year.
Earlier. Okay.
Yeah.
And then how was that 7 months with you?
It was
full time.
It was tough. Honestly, being by myself, like it was very solitary, very lonely. And on top of it, I was actually just talking to Ethan today about this, that it was a very weird transition where I always thought that I had all this freedom at my job and stuff, but it's very different when you go from like, okay, I've got to be at this place for 10 hours every day, and I have a list of things that I need to do. Like, I'm being told exactly what I need to do and what I need to execute. And then you go on your own, and you're like, well, I don't have to go until like 8 or 9, and then I'll just work later. And then you're like, well, but I want to go home at 5, and then you just get like nothing done that day. And it was a complete relearning of like being self-motivated and, you know, just not wanting to let down my customers and wanting to do good work in my own business. And it was strange. It was kind of I wouldn't say it was like an ego hit, but it was like something that I never thought I would deal with, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Interesting. Okay, so this is semi aligned with a question we had from James Dyer, maybe. I think there might have been someone else. We'll get to questions later, but this might accidentally answer it. My question is how did you start managing your time? Do you have I really need to start here and try to end around here. I mean, how did you do that? How long did it take you to figure that out?
I would say it took me a solid 2 or 3 months to figure that out. Like, I spent like the first month or two, like really sleeping in, getting in whenever I wanted, not really following a schedule, working as hard as I could while I was there.
Yeah.
And then probably taking off early because I was like, oh, I can go home and, you know, see my wife and hang out. And like, why wouldn't I do this? And then I would get to the end of the week and I'm like, cool. Now I've got 3 or 4 14-hour days to actually get the parts done that I needed to get done. And this sucks. Yeah. And, you know, you beat your head against the wall enough times and eventually you start learning a lesson. I would say that, like, I went full time in November. I'd say like probably by the end of February, I was starting to hold a more reasonable schedule, be in there for a certain amount of time and really kind of take to it. It's like, okay, this is still a job. Whether or not I've got somebody yelling at me if I'm late, like, I should still be in around the same time every day. I should still work around the same number of hours. And, you know, if I got to take off early for a doctor's appointment, it's awesome. I don't have to talk to anybody now. But, like, you should still treat it like a job. And it just took a while to kind of nail that home, I think.
Yeah. Good. And you keep a pretty regular-ish schedule now?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not like within 5 minutes, but I'm here within half an hour of each other, and I leave. My leaving times have gotten much later and, you know, less consistent, I would say. Like, sometimes great, I can leave at 2 because I've got to go ship stuff and I got to go take care of some errands, but like usually it's 5, 6, 7 midnight if it's a long day.
I had my own business doing contract programming stuff for a long time. The reason I got out of it is because I could not hold up regular hours. Had a daughter, which we'll talk about probably soon. And I was just like, what a terrible life. I'm putting her to bed at 8. I work from 8 to 2 in the morning, try to sleep, wake up, do all that stuff. And I never had the discipline to, like, hey, I just need to work certain hours. I had some good mentor business friends that were like, there's always just, you could literally just work forever. So you have to put some bookends on that. Sometimes that's, you know, 12, 13, 14 hours for some people and it doesn't kill them. Sometimes it's 8 or 10 hours and it doesn't kill them. But, so that's good to hear that you figured that out pretty quick. Okay. So now Brad, fast forward to Brad, what machines did you have in November of 2021?
So we had our Kitamura still. We had bought in 2018 a Brother S700.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was it. No, I can't remember if we had bought our... We had our Kitamura. We had an older Brother that we bought from Dennis Rathi. And then we had a Brother S700 by that point, because we bought that one after going to IMTS we went in 2018, ended up actually seeing our machine in another booth. And then it came out as like a demo unit for a great price. And we're like, sure, let's jump on that.
So what is the configuration of the S700? Just a 3-axis machine, or is it a palette changing machine, or
just a 3-axis?
I'm not a Brother guy. I mean, I appreciate a Brother as much as any non-Brother owner.
Right.
All the U500 is the only one I actually know.
Right. It's just a 700 by 400, I think, or 700 by 350, something like that. Travel.
Cool.
3-axis mill. We had a high torque 10K spindle, dual contact. Mm-hmm. It was our first new machine that really either of us had run. So it like had probing and tool setting, and it was like, oh man, okay, we can kind of see the writing on the wall for the Kitamura and all that stuff at that point.
Yeah. touch on some questions. We'll kind of answer them along the way. Who was it? Somebody asked. We'll probably get to them later. But how did you justify that machine? How did that feel?
Oh, terrifying. I can start there for sure. It was, both of us were very nervous, but we had kind of set these goals of like, okay, we need, before either of us could go full time, we needed at least one new machine that had service. Cause like we had had service issues with our Kitamura. Like at one point the main board went out and we were down for two or three weeks where we like had it reflowed by some third party company. And then it worked for like a month. And then it went down again, and then we had to buy a new one from Yaskawa and reinitialize all that. And, like, thankfully that worked. Okay. And we just had all these small issues over the years where we knew that we needed something where it's like, I need to be able to call someone. Because when we called Yaskawa about that machine, they were like, well, we can have somebody out there in 2 weeks, but it's going to be, like, $3,500 before they get to your door because you're paying for, you know, hotels and airfare and per diem and all that stuff from California. And I was like, so we can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
And so that was one of the big pushes to get a new machine.
Yeah.
And we kind of justified it as like, it was a cheap enough machine and we had enough for a down payment that if everything went to shit and we had to go back and find jobs, Brad and I could split the payments every month.
Yeah.
And be okay. Like it would suck and that we'd have to really budget and eat a lot of ramen, but like we could make it through it if we had to, kind of thing.
Cool. Cool. So then moving forward to Brad, what was the decision to bring Brad in full time?
We had enough work to justify it. And like I said, he
was wanting it.
He was really wanting it. And it felt very unfair of me to be like, no, you can't have the freedom that I'm having.
And
he was working night shift this entire time. Like the entire time I've known him, he was on night shift and he's a morning person. Like he loves to get up at 6.
Oh.
But he was working 2 to midnight or 2 to 1 4 days a week. And so it just didn't feel at all fair to say like, no, I get to pick my own schedule, but you get to do the thing that you hate continuously forever.
Yeah.
So.
So before we transition off of history, story, all that stuff, tell us about 2021, 2022. Now it's a few years later.
Yeah, just been slowly growing. We added another 2 brothers since then.
Mm-hmm.
We had added another S700 and then an F600, which is their high rigidity model. And then we really were just, you know, starting to feel the space. We were in 1,000 square feet with 3 CNCs, you know, all the auxiliary equipment. The office was like, you know, smaller than the room I'm in. And that was our inspection, kitchen, packing, you know, receiving everything room. And we had installed a mini split in our suite, but it was enough for like a 20 degree differential. And so it's Arizona. We get 115 days. So it'd still be 95 in the shop and you're just sweating and the humidity's high because of coolant mist. I mean, you know, we had mist extractors on every machine, but it still bumps up the humidity so much. And so we were just miserable. Like it just sucked. And so last year, we kind of it was really like 2 years ago, we started looking for a place and it took about a year to find a place. Finally, Justin put me in contact with a friend of a friend who ended up being the vice president of a real estate company here.
Chuck and Justin Gray, Toolpath Justin?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
He, awesome. He knew I was struggling and he was like, you know what? I think I can pull some strings. Yeah.
That's great.
And he put us in contact with this guy who was VP of a fairly big real estate agency here. And he ended up being our real estate agent. And we went out and saw 3 or 4 places with him. And the one that I'm in right now was the winner. You know, we went from 1,000 square feet to 4,900 square feet, 2,200, 2,300 of it his manufacturing area, and the rest is offices and bathrooms and kitchens and stuff.
Air-conditioned?
All air-conditioned, more power so we could get a bigger machine, all that stuff. And nice. At the right around the same time that we found it, this was 2023, end of the year, one of our customers reached out and was like, hey, we love working with you, but we need more capacity. Like, what can we do on our end to make you want to give us more capacity?
And yeah, so they like
drop their payment terms a little bit to make things a little easier on us. And we were like, all right, if you're willing to do that, we'll buy another machine. And so the stars aligned, and a friend locally had bought a Hermless E250, mm-hmm. actually at my advice had bought a Hermless E250.
Yeah.
And ended up kind of changing gears and needing to get rid of it. And this all happened at the exact same time. And I was like, yeah, I'll take it. Like, that was the machine I told you to buy because that's what I wanted. So, sure.
No, it's garbage. I don't want it.
And oh, that's so, great. Yeah, we bought that and that moved in with us. We moved in here February of last year, February 2024.
Yeah.
And just have been growing like crazy since then.
Well, Justin kind of screwed up my question that I was going to ask, but I was going to say, like, how do you find a place? Because, Northern California, so I'm in Sacramento-ish. So freaking hard for a machine shop to find a place. To be honest, a lot of what would have been machine shops not many years ago are growing weed or doing something mm-hmm. with weed. Is that a thing down there?
Oh yeah, yeah. We've got legal marijuana as of two.
Oh, I had no idea.
2 years. A fair while ago.
It's grossly changed machine shop building ownership and machine shop leasing in Northern California. Selway can't find a place to buy or release. It's whatever it is. So that's what I was going to ask, is how do you find a place? Sounds like having a good network of people that love you is probably not a bad place.
And I cannot recommend finding a real estate agent more. Like, they didn't charge us anything because they get paid when the lease is signed. And so I cannot, because we contacted a bunch of people through like LoopNet and stuff and went and saw.
So you were trying to do it yourself before.
Oh, yeah. And they were just, without a real estate agent to be our backer and like somebody to advocate for us, they were unwilling to bring anything to the owners. Like, we would go to a place that didn't have AC and say like, hey, do you think that he'd be willing to like split a full AC unit with us? Nope. Mm-hmm. We don't think so. He doesn't want to put any money into it. And I'm like,
got it. Okay.
Do you think that he'd be willing for us to put AC? I don't think he wants to modify the building at all. It's like, okay, sure. Great. Thanks. It's Arizona, guys. Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not like you're in Seattle.
Right.
The good nugget out of that. That's the good nugget out of that is find a commercial realtor.
Yep. 100%.
Good.
Yeah.
I mean, I know countless people that have really struggled with that all over the country, but especially in Sacramento, because that's where I'm at. Any regrets in machine or equipment purchases?
Nope. Love the Hermlock.
Damn.
The place. Yeah. Okay. I mean, we're actively starting to look at buying another Hermlock. Not only fantastic machines to work with, but so the people are so fantastic. Like that.
Yeah.
As our shop has grown and as things have continued to go, like we love working with companies that are so customer service obsessed.
Yeah.
And Hermel is one of those.
It's probably why you like to work with Toolpath.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Mostly a joke, but hopefully that's
not really.
Yeah, hopefully we're making it genuine, right?
Yeah.
So I did an AU class for any non-Autodeskers. AU is Autodesk University. I think it was the first year I was there. So we're talking 10 years ago. Al asked me to do a class at AU about starting a machine shop. And to kind of dovetail into your point you just said, was I was sitting there thinking, I've helped a bunch of shops kind of start from nothing, start from an idea to building out a shop. And I remember, like, man, it's all about having good relationships with your vendors. Not to proselytize Selway, but Selway Machine Tool in Northern California. I've had a long relationship with them, and like no other company I've ever worked with, I've never heard other customers like, I'll only buy through so-and-so, through Selway. And I was always super intrigued by that. I'm like, why? But tell me why. And they all had some story about some heroics that Selway, on a Saturday, they crashed a machine and they called Bill Selway. And Bill Selway called, whoever, to go help them fix their machine on a Sunday. And they like, they saved my business. Or Bill Selway, you know, helped me postpone some payments, you know, all that kind of stuff. And when I started working at Autodesk is when I started thinking about Bill as like a business, industry partner, you know, kind of like that perspective, not like customer and vendor. Mm-hmm. And I've had some late nights with Bill Selway, the late great Bill Selway's since passed away. And he was one of our industry legends, but he was just like, Tim, it's all about relationships. You know, people trust you. They need to trust you. You know, they need to build their business on companies they can trust. And, so I share that with my team. So, you know, I'm the chief customer officer or something like that at Toolpath. And that shows a lot. You know, one of the first big hires that Al made was me to focus on the customer. And it said a lot about Toolpath and how much we care about customers. You know, we could have hired a lot more developers and, you know, other salespeople and all that kind of stuff. But he was like, no, it starts with our community of, you know, people and a relationship with our customers. And that's something that, you know, I'm shy and all that kind of stuff, but like, I've always like really valued those like real connections. And mm-hmm. I swear I hear Bill Selway, you know, have that conversation with me, you know, time and time again about how it's just really, it's about relationships and people trust that relationship. So,
yeah. I mean, this business is hard enough without having seriously. To like be your own advocate on every single little thing. Like you really want somebody who just does right by you. And if something's wrong, they'll work with you about it. And that's
every time
all you can
pick
ask.
Up the phone. Yeah. Every time you pick up the phone, they're not, you know, their first question isn't how they're going to bill you for it. Right. Mm-hmm. You had James Myatt on the Within Tolerance podcast. Like, you know how many times he's like just late texted people to help them through their problems and stuff like that. I'm glad you have that with Hermla. I don't know enough about how they sell machines and how they support them. Like how do you get support and sales and all that regionally down in Arizona?
It's all direct, and actually mm-hmm. a year ago, I want to say, or maybe a little less than that, they opened a office in Phoenix, but up until that, it was all through their headquarters in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. They'll, like, their service is so great that they'll just overnight whatever they think could be the problem. The guy shows up, uses what he needs to, and then sends whatever doesn't work back. Like, that's we had a little bump on the Hermla maybe a month or two ago, and I was like, I think everything's okay.
Can you explain what a bump is, Dylan?
I ran a tool and part of a PG collet into a part because we didn't have our post simulating connection moves.
Okay.
And the module works stuff that's in Fusion kind of does some wonky approach stuff in Tool 5.
Okay.
It all looked okay. Ran kinematics. Kinematics still looked good. But I asked them to come out and just check it. And like a couple days later, three giant Pelican cases got overnighted to us.
No
next
way.
Day, Tyler, our fantastic tech, showed up. He had everything at his disposal he needed, you know, giant granite square, vibration meter for the spindle, ball bar, drawbar force tester, everything. And like within 3 hours had recertified the machine to better than factory specs again.
That's wonderful.
And then was off, you know, and like, they were like, hey, we'll send you labels to get it back to us. And it was like painless. There was no
freaking nice.
Yeah. And just so professional. Like that's what I want when I'm scared that I just damaged my most expensive machine.
Yeah. So that's good that we still see that with non-Selway customers, right? And when I hear that thing that resonated with me was I was now at Autodesk and interacting with Selway customers and like, why only Selway? And they're like, they would tell me basically the story you just said. Well, they just shipped everything to me and made sure that I was good, make sure I felt confident that my Matsura was dialed in. So that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay. So you said you're getting another one soon?
We're looking at it right now, I would have ordered it today if money was no issue, but they're expensive machines. The next one we're looking at getting automation and their extended tool magazine and all that stuff. So it kind of jumps things up into the next class in terms of money.
How did you tell me about how did you justify that machine? That's not a little purchase. Many machinists I know are very pragmatic, spreadsheety kind of people, and sometimes it's hard to spreadsheet the justification for that out. But I know you have said a bunch of times on different podcasts I've listened to you from Within Tolerance, or like, dang, it just prints money, kind of stuff.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Tell me more about how you work through that.
I'm not a great spreadsheet logical kind of person. I look at rough numbers. I do, some quick and dirty calculations, but I'm not somebody to sit there and spend 8 hours going through every little nickel and dime.
Yeah.
We've done well up into this point, kind of understanding the money that's coming in, the money that's going out.
Yeah.
And I don't know, feeling the winds on our sails, I guess. Winds are feeling strong. We're still going well. We're still growing. And the other big thing is that Brad and I really don't want to hire right now. I don't think that if I hired somebody to be a machinist in my shop right now, I wouldn't see profit from them where I could leave them alone and make parts for till 2026 maybe. And I got a baby on the way, like you've touched on. Automation seems like the way to do this. A pallet changing Hermla, I could start using it today if it was installed. I've had four or five orders in the last month that all would have benefited, and I could have ran for 15 to 20 hours overnight kind of stuff.
Yeah. What's the biggest bottleneck in your shop?
Programming right now, probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would say.
Adding a bunch of pallets to feed. How much does that help that? That doesn't make
a
it
lot
better.
Of it. A lot of it is we'll get an order. We do a lot of very small tool, very intricate part stuff. And so we have cycles between 1 and 2 hours quite frequently.
Yeah.
And I'll have to make 5 or 10 of them. And it's if I can run one during the day and then say, okay, let's run the other 4 at night. That's 8 hours right there. So that's really why we're looking at it.
Quite a bit. Good.
Yeah.
Good. I don't know many shops thriving that aren't using some sort of palletized systems.
Yeah.
And actually, so we're jumping around a bit, but somebody asked. Yeah, let's go through the comments one by one later. But I was going to touch on somebody mentioned paperless parts and toolpath. Let's talk about your quoting. And then maybe we'll re-answer it when we get to the questions. But you use paperless parts and toolpath. When did you start using paperless parts, and then how did you decide that was a good idea?
Paperless was 2 years ago now, I think. Two and a half, maybe. Okay. And really, it was just because it was becoming a bottleneck. It was something where I was using a spreadsheet that was given to me by an old coworker, and then heavily massaging the numbers, okay, this is what this says, but really, it's actually this. Yeah. And what it made it is that I was the black magic in our quoting system. Brad could never really jump in and go, oh, well, I want to quote something. It's
I'll take this. Yeah.
It's like, man, I don't know. I'm doing dice rolls and adding it to the shop rate to like get the number that I want. Like, I don't know. And so we needed some way to standardize that and create a process around it. And that's what paperless parts let us do.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of a no brainer at that point. And, you know, I have a lot of friends that use it and they all liked it. And so we jumped in on it.
Are you using, there's like a customer side of that experience. Are you using that too?
A little bit, yeah. So we send a lot of digital quotes. I really like not sending PDFs and not having to manually confirm stuff. Like, I still have customers that don't want to use that stuff, and so they don't use it. But I've got a few customers that do, too. And so I just, like, get an email like, hey, so-and-so added an RFQ to your queue. I go and look at it, send them a quote, and then it's like, you got an order from this RFQ or from this quote, you know, and that's... It's so hands off for me that it makes things so much easier on my end.
Good, good.
Yeah.
Something that I've seen paperless parts customers utilize and also attribute like significant revenue growth to was paperless parts had a way, and it's been a while since I looked at it, but it had a way of showing people if you need it hyper fast, there's this multiplier. If you need it fast, it's this multiplier, a smaller multiplier, and they kind of trickle down to like their normal 6 to 8 week lead time. Is that something you utilize and found useful, or
maybe in 15 or 20% of our quotes? Okay. Most of our customers are looking for parts tomorrow, and like when I say tomorrow, I literally mean 3 to 5 days.
Yeah,
and so it's like I just basically can't offer them an expedite. Like everything's an expedite. Everything's a fire. Yeah. I'm putting it out. Like, that's the kind of thing. And so they want it by a certain date. And sometimes I'll push back on that by like 1 or 2 days if we just don't have it in the schedule. But I don't have capacity to be like, oh, do you actually want that 2 days earlier? It's just like, no, this is the earliest I can get material, program it, get it through the machine and get it to you.
Yeah. James Dyer, Toolpath customer, and I think, Insta friend of yours or whatever. One of his questions, I'll go off my memory, but he was asking like, how do you handle scheduling? So that's something I struggle with. I used to struggle with when I was a real machinist. How do you handle scheduling?
Poorly, I would say. Right now, the way that we're doing it to make sure that it works is that I touch base with Brad twice a day. Like once when he comes in after he gets settled, I'm like, all right, you're working on this and it's going to ship this date. I'm working on this. It's going to ship this date. If a new quote comes in, we talk about what is on the schedule and if there's room for that to fit in there. I would love some kind of calendar. Like Pete was on the cusp of creating the perfect scheduler for me in Chatter. And I'm hoping that continues because like being able to drag overlapping jobs and see where they fit both on machines and just general workload is tough. It's really tough. And like you can create like a Google calendar if you really wanted to and try to do it that way. But I think scheduling is probably a bear that a lot of shops are dealing with. And right now communication is just the only way I can do it.
Got it. So that touches on, explain the day-to-day for you and Brad and how you interact together, how you run the shop.
I just kind of get to work, you know, come in. Like I get in earlier than he does.
Okay.
No, I get in maybe an hour and a half earlier than he does.
Mm-hmm.
I start the machines, start warm-ups, all that stuff, take care of any quotes that came in, you know, overnight or in the early morning. Mm-hmm. And then I start on whatever jobs have been assigned to me. And then he gets in, starts on any jobs that he's working on. And like I said, we touch base when he comes in. Oh, you're working on this. Okay, cool. You think it's going to be done tomorrow? Okay, cool. I'm going to work on this and this and this. And we'll meet back. And then maybe we'll touch base at lunchtime and then definitely before he goes home and before somebody goes to ship that day.
Yeah, got it. So you're just figuring it out. That's the answer.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I mean, cool. Like when everything's on fire, nothing's on fire. Is that saying?
And so the saying. That's one of my favorite. Yeah.
So like we're constantly playing that game of like, what's the hottest fire? And then like, okay, let's make sure that the water's going there first, and then we can kind of trickle it down to the rest.
I think it's literally when everything's hot, nothing's hot, right? Because it's a temperature differential. If it's on fire, it's on fire.
Right.
Okay, so I'm looking at my notes. Business background, machine tech. I don't know, what's some of the more interesting kind of game-changing tech that you have at the shop? I know you're a big PG fan.
Yes.
Yeah, just capped on tape kind of came up as my notes. kind of some of your more important tech. Let's go there.
Sure.
In your shop.
I mean, we can hit like, you know, the highlight, the, you know, fancy stuff is, yeah, PG, all of our standard tools are in Power Grip. Mm-hmm. Many of our other tools are in Power Grip. It's been an absolute game changer. It is mm-hmm. bar none the best tool system out there. It's mm-hmm. just so expensive, eye-wateringly expensive.
I'll tell the story in a minute. Keep going.
Yeah, and then Lang on everything. Both of our 3-axis have Lang base plates. Our Hermla has Lang base plates. We put Lang studs in both of the, or all of the 6-inch orange vices we have, so we can pop them on and off. Like, I haven't swept in a vice in 2 years.
Good.
Probably.
Yeah.
It's that kind of stuff. Like, when you're working that fast, like, you don't have time to do simple stuff like that. I don't want to sweep in a vice. Same thing, like, we use a lot of Carve Smart jaws in the 3-axis because I don't want to have to worry about running into cap screws, and I don't want to change cap screws ever again. Like, oh, my God, I cannot stand changing cap screw jaws. It's terrible.
Chick one lock vice, I'm not suggesting it, but that's
same thing,
my
though.
Favorite. Yeah, it's my favorite, and that's the reason right there.
Just yeah.
pop them in and out, don't have to worry about cap screws. Yeah. Keep going.
Amazing.
Keep going,
sorry. So Captain Tape, like, we use a lot of the powder coat tape, like tape and glue method that Saunders popularized. Mm-hmm. I would say Brad has put the hours in to become an expert. Like, he is probably top in the world. If there was a tape and glue competition, I'd send him without even worrying about a first place. Like, this guy regularly cuts the color off of powder coating tape and leaves the tape underneath. Like, he is that good.
Nice.
So that we use a lot for thin parts, stuff that like you normally wouldn't be able to do. Like, we've made 7,000 shim parts.
No kidding.
Tape and glue out of stainless steel. And like, you know, you look at them normally and you're like, how am I going to even approach that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
I've done
lots of shim stuff at when I was at L3. It's not my favorite thing to do. That actually is intriguing to me. So Justin went down there for a little R&R internship thing. You guys have talked about that. Go find that podcast. It's a good one. But he came back and he's like, hey, there's this Kapton tape workflow that Dylan and Brad have that, we should do a thing about it. I was like, yeah, let's do it. You know, it was like one of the 1,000 things we could do. That's awesome.
Right. Of course. Yeah.
Okay. So that's a good one. Maybe I'll poke Justin and Ben to do some, do a little video about that. So you said, I haven't seen it. You said Saunders has highlighted that in some YouTube stuff?
Years ago. Like, this was 5 years ago, maybe, or something. He was doing some videos about it on his YouTube. And we started using it because we were doing these automotive grills for a customer. Mm-hmm. And we did like the big ones first on vacuum, and they worked great. Mm-hmm. And then we swapped to these small wiper grill ones.
Oh.
Thought I had a great plan for it. We had like the prototype run of them. And my fixture was just an absolute mess. It did not work at all. Mm. Parts were flinging off left and right. And I was kind of pulling my hair out, changing stuff, trying to make go slower, not pull these parts off the vacuum. And then finally I was like, you know what we got to do? We just got to, like, we only had 8 of them. So it was like, all right, we just got to try this tape and glue thing. We've never done it before. I've watched the video on it.
Yeah.
Saunders says it works. Let's give it a shot. And it worked perfectly. We made it through the whole order. It's kind of a pain in the ass to set up because you're taping the parts without bubbles. You're taping your fixtures. You're putting the glue in, but not too much, but not too little. And you're weighing it down and letting it cure. And it's not a fast workflow by any means. Yeah. But, man, we got it done. Parts came out great. Customer was super happy with them. And it saved my bacon. And then since then, I want to say that maybe like 6 months after Brad started full time. Like he started taking it on more and more and really was like, okay, this is going to be my niche within the company. And since then, like he knows, like if he sees a flat, thin part in paperless, he's just like, ugh, this is for me, isn't it? And I'm like, yep, that's for you, man. Like,
yeah, you got this. Yeah.
Yep.
That's great. That highlights kind of the sum of the story of our industry, right? As we all kind of find these little niche things. I think the shops that I see do well are the ones that find their little niche and exploit it, right? So that's great. Any other fun tech stuff to share?
We bought an annealing oven last year. Well, I mean, late last year for plastics, and that's helped a ton. That was
Tell me more.
So like, you know, Delrin, Peak, things like that. You've machined them before, you know, that they turned, you know, Pringles pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we do a lot of fairly large hog outs in Delrin. And so, you know, you rough everything on one side, leave a quarter inch, flip it over, rough everything to a quarter inch, throw it in the annealing oven overnight. And then it's all, it takes all the warp out. Or, I mean, it warps quite a bit.
Yeah.
Then but it's done. It doesn't warp from then on. Yeah. Mickey Jacobs was the one who shared that with me. And we were like, all right, you know, we started doing more and more plastic. And I was like, all right, we got to try this because this is.
Give me a rough temperature. Like,
it really depends. I know Bodecker Plastics has a full sheet on it. So if you just search Bodecker Plastics annealing temperatures, you'll get a full sheet and it'll be like, okay, for nylon, it's this. Plus this much or this length of soak per quarter inch and then air dry or whatever. And it just works. It's awesome. It
would have changed my life if you would have come to me 15 years ago with that. I've made some real flip type Delrin parts. You know, just flip them. They came out fine, but we rough them and then we would let them just sit for a week or whatever. And that kind of helped. And, that's interesting. So hopefully people are sharpening their pencils and taking notes.
It's a little bit of investment, but I think we spent like $4,000 on the oven and just in the headache saved, it's been worth it every penny.
And that's easy to believe.
Information is pretty free out there in terms of like times and temperatures. So it hasn't been an issue.
Yeah. One of the things moving on from tech, because my funny PG story, so Power Grip story. James Myatt, this is probably the third time I've mentioned him. I don't have a huge man crush on him, just a little one. I think he was the first person who was like, dude, this is the stuff. And I saw the price and was like, okay. And at the time, I think the first time I really considered them was I was an Autodesker doing trade show demos, and I was really looking for tool holders that I could swap parts at swap tools at shows, right? You know, we're supposed to be running everything at 800, you know, some crazy fast, almost, I had to stop myself, had to run stuff very fast and exciting. Which also came with some broken tools from time to time. But so I was exploring different options. At the time, I was a shrink fit fan. So Hydra holders, Uber chucks, if anybody's ever run Uber chucks, were like a really neat, still one of my favorite tools. Milling chucks, I kind of hate, to be honest. And I could never get like a good demo set up for PG holders, but I've since used them and there's nothing you can say bad about them other than their expense. Maybe some of the time it takes to clean them properly and whatnot. So fast forward, at IMTS, we're way overfilled in an Uber, me, Justin, a bunch of other people. Somehow PG holders came up and I say to Justin Gray from Toolpath, you talked him into like going full PG holders on our little brother at our shop. Now our shop is a little lab for us to go play around with and make parts. And I just popped off with, Yeah, it was pretty ridiculous that we have a bunch of PG holders. And he got all serious, and he wanted me to justify why it was ridiculous. And I remember being like, you can't justify why it's a bad idea to buy PG holders, other than that it's just expensive.
Right.
And I was like, that's like saying it's bad to be handsome and rich. Like, there's nothing really wrong with it, right?
Yeah. Yep.
But anyway, that was my funny PG story.
One other tech thing too that I'll put since Simon asked a question at Freddie, is we have a Freddie and I know Justin does too, and like man, as somebody who has been on his hands and knees throughout my career cleaning sumps and all that stuff, that's something I would buy 10 times over. Like, again, and again, talking about companies that are just obsessively customer focused, Simon is one of the best people ever. And like, I'm so happy to not only use his products, but like support his company, because he's just the best.
So I have never used a Freddy. I don't have room in my garage for one, or I maybe have one. But I used Sump Shark or something like that at maybe a few places back in 20 years ago or something. And there was one with a problem. I don't want to say anything bad about Sump Shark, but it wasn't a great experience. And one of the things I wanted to talk about today was like just social media. Like, I was trying to weave in like how it's impacted you and, you know, your shop. And I think that dovetails really well into Freddie, right? I've heard nothing but wonderful things about the Freddie. For anybody that doesn't know, go check them out, especially if you're on Instagram. They're really engaged with the community. I have yet to hear anything bad about them. It's also like, it's hard to say anything bad about something that makes it really easy to clean out yourself, right?
Right.
Also, like, being handsome and rich, like, what's the downside? What's the downside of that?
Yeah.
And
it's from high-fiving all day. That's the
exactly.
Downside,
right? No, you're awesome. Sorry to belittle it, but it's a freaking vacuum that sucks out stuff from your sump. It's like the least cool thing in the shop, until you use one, right? And until you work with the company. So, kudos to everyone over there. I think they've done a wonderful job being engaged with the community and, really just shown how powerful this like Insta machinist community is. So, yeah, it's been fun for me to watch, right? Like when I started, maybe we can talk about it for a minute, but when I started at Autodesk, I was kind of like anti-social media. Like I had a very strong network of local machinists that I was really good friends with, texted each other like schoolgirls, right? And that was like my network of, I'm in my mid-40s, later 40s now. Like, we were the young guns of the machining world. And, but we were texting, we were like each other's support system. And my knowledge of the internet machinist community was pretty toxic, to be honest. It was, there's a very popular machinist forum that, I don't surround myself with negative people. So like I go there, I'm like, nope, this ain't me. You know, if somebody asks a question, they get flame. Right. And there's some pieces of answers in these, like how stupid you are comments. Right.
Right.
And I was just like, nope, don't need that in my life. And then there's another CAM system that's real popular that has their like e-forum thing. And it was real similar there. I was part of that community for a long time. I actually met some people I'm very close with there, but, I just remember being like, does everybody hate people so much? Like, I just don't want to be a part of it. So now fast forward, I'm at Autodesk just trying to be a good application engineer. And my boss, one of the best bosses I've ever had, Joe Bailey, he was like, hey, Timmy, you got to get on social media. And I was like, no. I don't do it. I'm on Facebook. So 2015, I had a 4 or 5 6 year old daughter, something like that. Like, I have Facebook to share pictures with my mom and my aunts. Like, that's the reason Facebook exists for me. Mm. And he's like, no, you get to see rad stuff all day. Like, that's what I did, is like, I ran around and helped people in their shops. And he's like, just post about that stuff. People love that stuff. I'm like, no. And then, you know, CJ Abraham pretty well. Shout out to CJ. We were at a trade show up in Portland, Oregon. I mean, they were talking first couple weeks or months of my job at Autodesk. He was an intern at the time. And we were walking through the halls and I was complaining and bitching about how Joe wanted me to start some social media. Didn't care what it was. Just start something, Twitter or something like that. I went on Twitter and I was like, I don't get it. I don't like it. I don't get it.
Yeah.
And then CJ was like, dude, Instagram. I'm like, no, Instagram's like pornography for like hot rod people and all that stuff, right? Like, I don't need that shit. That's a distraction.
Right.
And he was like, no, there's an Insta community, Insta machinist community that seems pretty cool. There's, back in the day, it was like Kamal, you know, from Central California. Rob Lockwood was a big part of that. Our buddy Amish was there.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, he talked me into it. And I've changed my picture. For a long time, I was at the tram station in Portland. I looked actually kind of pissed off. I took a picture. I looked kind of pissed off. And that was my Instagram picture for a long time. But it's changed my life. I mean, it sounds hyperbolic, but I mean, I've met people like you. I do dirt bike races. Like, I was up in Virginia City at a pretty famous dirt bike race that I was racing, and just some random dude at a dirt bike race, like, looked like he's 12 feet tall. I'm 6'2". He was quite a bit taller than me. He was like, "One Air Tim." And I was like, "What the hell?" And this dude told me the most touching story of my life. Basically, I shared some story of me racing the year before after dealing with some paralysis. And he was like, I was just was given the clear from beating cancer.
Oh, wow.
Thinking like my body's just almost died. And he was like, I decided to get in dirt bike racing and come race this race.
Wow.
And
how cool.
I was like, holy shit. So it's just... that's my encouragement to the rest of the community to like, just get involved, be helpful, be nice. Don't be an asshole.
Yeah.
Right.
I think it's the best one out there for machinists. Oh, like the no Facebook doubt. Groups are terrible. Like you said, the forums are terrible. Yeah. Really the Discord is like the only other one that I'm really happy with. But for the most part, like so much of it is that old world toxicity of like, oh, I got to put you down before I like help you out. You know, I got to tell you how dumb you are. And then I'll tell you what I think you should do.
Have you dealt with much of that in industry? Have you dealt with much of that in like the shop level?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. That first job I worked in, that was kind of why I gravitated to Instagram at that point was that everyone there was much older than me. And, you know, some of them were nice, but it wasn't like there was no collaboration. There was still very much like, oh, you know, mind your own business. Don't steal my job kind of stuff. I got on Instagram for like motorcycle stuff. And then when we started Protium, I started the Protium Instagram. And, you know, that was when it kind of took off of just like, oh man, this community is amazing.
It's pretty special. I was meaning to ask earlier, what kind of motorcycle did you crash?
A 2005 ZX10R. And then I bought a Supermoto. Like a month before I could really walk 100% right.
KTM.
And then I bought a Husqvarna SM610. Yeah. And then I bought a 2013 BMW S1000.
Cool.
And that was the last bike I had. I sold that a couple years ago.
Welcome to my life getting... tangents. Oh, wife driven.
Yeah. Oh, well, like I wasn't riding it that much because like for the longest time I daily rode that S1000 for the longest time. And then we just started like shipping more parts and stuff. And I was like, I need a car to like take stuff to FedEx every single day now. Like I can't.
Seems reasonable.
And so I stopped riding it for a while. And she was like, you know, I really, worried every single time you threw your leg over that. And I was like, all right, you know, I'm not using it. I'll get rid of it. I'll buy another one someday. And I'm sure I will. But right now, obviously, priorities have changed a little bit.
I broke my left tib fib pretty gnarly when my ex-wife was, I don't know, 7 months pregnant, something like that.
Oh, no.
It put a pause on my dirt bike riding for a while.
I bet.
All right, enough dirt bike talk. We talked a little bit about the community. I think we beat that one pretty good. Podcast content creation. Yeah, podcast, I don't know what there is more to talk about that, but it's an interesting thing for me because before you came to me about being on the podcast, I was like, yeah, I'm not a podcaster. It's another distraction, right?
Right.
Now I actually listen to several machinist podcasts and podcasts that aren't have anything to do with machining. Kind of in the background, you know, I think there's plenty of people in the machining industry that share my ADD or whatever I'm self-diagnosing myself with. And it's actually pretty nice for me to have it kind of in the background. And so trying to think of what we can talk about. I don't think we have to force anything there. You started because somebody asked you, how much of a time burden does it feel to you?
I wouldn't say, So like not very often, but sometimes I will like have a podcast planned at the end of the day and be like, man, I'd really like to just go home and sleep or something and like, you know, go program or whatever, like spend time with my wife.
Yeah.
Literally the second I start recording, I'm like, man, I love this. Like, and really that's why I continue to do it. Like it is. Yes, has it brought us some business?
Yeah.
Yes. You know, that's been great. But like the main reason I do it is like I love the community. And like I love the community it is created. Cause like we've chatted occasionally over the years on Instagram. I didn't know your story. I didn't know your background. I didn't all that stuff. And like getting to connect with somebody for an hour or 2 hours or whatever.
Yeah.
That's a game changer. Like that is a true connection. And like and now I've got 250 episodes now? 251? Yeah.
No
kidding. So like I've got hundreds of people I can turn to. Like it's
so rad.
Very rare that I come across a problem that I'm like, oh, I know the perfect person to ask about this because I know that they talked about that or I know that they deal with this kind of part all the time. And I love being able to facilitate that for other people. Like people come to me, oh, what do you recommend for this? I'm like, honestly, I've never done that in my life, but go talk to Joe because he does it all the time. And like, that's fantastic.
That's great.
I love it.
That's great. Okay. I mean, that hits it. I mean, that's honestly, when we were talking about starting something for Toolpath, I mean, part of it is honestly to highlight, some cool stuff about Toolpath. And then, that's our selfish reason, but we're pretty focused on like, what can we do for the community to show people that we like give a lot of shit about our community. So that's kind of why we started it. We'll see where it goes. If it's something people like, we'll keep doing it. If not, we'll let you run with it. So, personal stuff.
I like having another voice in the group. You know, it's always nice to have another podcast to listen to.
Yeah, that's great. And I'm stoked that we're able to do this. We have the leadership support to do it. We're not looking to generate, you know, revenue from it, right? We're just looking to add goodness, show people. I mean, it's not just me in the podcast, but everybody on my team kind of has free run to do something if it's interesting. So we'll do some, you know, as a team together, Scott, Paul, Ben, you know, my team will basically have, you know, if they have a connection with someone that they think they could tell a good story, they'll share it. So. That'd fun awesome. Stuff. What do you do outside the shop? You don't ride motorcycles anymore.
What is time out of the shop?
You'll hopefully chisel some time out with your wife. How long have you been married?
Yeah. I think it's 4 years this year.
So, a little more confidence next time.
she honestly is right there with me because we've been dating for, I think, 15 years this year or would have been dating.
Got it.
And we got married on our dating anniversary to make it easy for both of us.
Oh, I love that idea. Yes.
Yeah. But what that's led to is that means that, like, it's just the same anniversary. And so I'm like, I think it's been 4 years this year.
I have to borrow that. Yeah. I'm over 10 years in.
Okay.
So maybe I'll borrow that someday. Yeah. Okay. And then outside of the shop, maybe the biggest news of your whole life, biggest thing of your whole life is you're going to be a girl dad here soon.
I sure am. Yeah, about the next month or so.
So the biggest well wishes I could possibly give you from everyone at Toolpath, that's the most life-changing best thing that's ever happened to me. Our buddy Jeff Tiedekin had a baby girl recently. And him and I were just
chatting about that. Yeah.
I was just texting him. I almost showed up late to this because I got distracted texting him. It's not the easiest early days, but they get better and better and better. Let me think. So our friend Sean from Instagram, it's Connor Manufacturing, right? Is that how you say that? Connour?
Yeah.
Connor Manufacturing. So he's a good dude in Central California. He had a video recently that just resonated with me. He was machining like Elon's face or something. I don't know if anybody saw that. But at the beginning, he was talking about like fresh year. He likes to go do some hard shit. And that resonated with me. I say often to my little circle of people, like, sign up for some hard shit and go figure it out, right? And that's kind of like my story of machine. He had a question, so I think it's time to transition to questions. I'm gonna start with that one because we were talking girl dad stuff. His question: in the spirit of Dylan becoming a father, I would love to hear some dad advice from you and the rest of us. So Carol's my girlfriend. We were walking my dog Theo right before this podcast, and I was like, Sean asked this question. I should probably bullet point it because I could probably turn it into a half-hour podcast of terrible advice from Tim. I didn't do that. So here's my overall feel and thinking of being a father, and I'm gonna really nail down a girl dad. I think is even more special or different. We talked about it early. I can't remember. Did we talk about this before we started recording or
we started talking a little bit about it, but we didn't really get into it. Yeah.
So I just wanted a healthy kid. I was born with one ear. I didn't want a kid with one ear. Comes with its own thing. I remember thinking it'd be less bummed if I had a boy with one ear than a girl with one ear. That's a dumb perspective. A boy can just fight his way through being made fun of, which doesn't lead you to anything good. But, so I started wanting just a healthy kid. And then the first time I saw the ultrasound, I was like, oh, holy crap. I don't know what to do. And I just felt like I could raise a boy with any aggressiveness that I have naturally. Right. I know what it took for me to get to, like you were saying earlier, I know what it takes for me to get to this age. And I feel like I was just worried about breaking, like, of mice and men, you know, George, you know, breaking his mouse and all that stuff. I felt like I'm George or Larry or whatever his name was. So to try to drill it down in advice, I think of being a parent, like, where we have these little science experiments, and this is me getting out of giving like real hard advice, but we have these little science experiments, and unfortunately, like, you have this hypothesis, you put this experiment into place, you work on the experiment, and then I think around the age 25, you find out how you did. and so my daughter's 17. It's just plenty of time to screw things up. But I could not be more proud of how things have gone. If I was thinking of some themes that I'm proud of and happy about is... I really try to feed her like independence and curiosity. you know, a lot of the little early toys I would buy for her had to do with like solving problems and fixing things. I have a picture of her, man, she had to have been 3 years old. We bought her this little like wooden kitchen thing. And that little sucker realized the hot and cold were backwards. And so she went and got her toolbox, which I think she still has and is pretty proud of. So buy your kid, especially, you know, I'm going to say buy your kid their own set of tools at a young age. Teach them how to put them back where they belong and all that stuff. So she went and got her own toolkit, and I have a picture of her under her own sink, like a plumber, her little belly showing, trying to figure out how to swap the faucet handles.
That's amazing.
So we have a theme of like, you know, I had this thing where like, I don't want to teach her that she doesn't want a man or whatever, like in her life, but like she can do whatever she wants. If she needs help from somebody, anybody, it's a decision she makes. Right. And so she does have this knack for like wanting to learn how to do things, just enough to say she could do them. And then she doesn't want to like keep being a machinist is the main thing. Right. So I have a picture of her standing on a rag can, you know, those metal flip top rag cans.
Yeah.
At L3, she's probably five, handle jogging a VM3 over to probe like a $50,000 part. And I'm like, push that button. Okay. Dude. You know, it's probably, I don't know, 10 o'clock at night. 'Cause they came to visit me while I was working too late. And oh, I was like, hey, help me set this up. But for years she told people at school, like she machines satellite parts, right?
That's amazing.
So I don't want to go on too many tangents, but like expose them to as many things as you can. Our sports, I think definitely one of the themes that I've probably because my childhood, I was raised in a real competitive family. I think competitiveness is good. And so like, I have never let my daughter win at anything. if she's beat me, it's because she beat me. And I've had people like, that's not good. That's not healthy. But she's got a very healthy attitude towards competitiveness. We played mini golf a lot. So I think it's important for any parent to spend one-on-one time with their kid. She's got the two scorecards hanging on her mirror in her bedroom. One of them is, the first time she tied me in mini golf, and the other one is the first time she beat me in mini golf. and so she's a very, very good ballerina right now. And that's literally might be one of the things I hate more than anything. So if she doesn't listen to this, so I can share that, I don't share it openly with her. Her mom was into it, and it was actually a fairly toxic world, or can be. A lot of body image problems that come with it sometimes.
Right.
So I was super concerned about her getting into it, but I think we raised her with a healthy, you know, healthy place where she can take it real serious and not get hung up on all that. So the reason for bringing that up is like, she did all kinds of sports. She was very good at them. And then she wanted to get into ballet, and I wanted to like sabotage that. But I was also like, our kids have to find their own path to passion. Right. So to Carol's point, I should have bullet pointed that so I didn't drone on for half an hour, but
I think that's great. No, those are things I've thought about a lot. As her due date gets closer and closer. 'Cause like there's no way that I could instill like that kind of regimented stuff on my kid. 'Cause I'm the same kind of person who like I bounced around a million times and I've tried every single sport under the sun and every single hobby under the sun. And, you know, my wife still gets on my case because I'll start a new hobby and get super excited spend hundreds of dollars on all the new stuff for it. And then like get 80% good at it and be like, oh, that's enough. All right. Next thing, I'm bored.
Yeah. Yeah. I try to support, I think anybody, you know, they can find that thing that just ballet is the most terrible sport for practice. Like there's nothing fun about practicing ballet, right? It's like literally going to exercise for 30 hours a week, for like two performances a year. So it's this, like, if you can find something to support your kid that they're passionate enough to go like, do the hard work to do something, just pour their soul into it. You're a book reader, right? Book reader, book listener,
yep,
book reader,
both.
Book listener.
Strong
father. It's probably a little early for you. Strong fathers, strong daughters, is a good book to read.
Okay.
Like most books, like just looking for some cliff notes is like the goodness of it, right? But there's some really good ones in there that I take pretty seriously. I mean, the title in itself, if that's all you read, it says a lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
Being a strong father helps girls be strong daughters. So, probably say the same thing about your boys too. That's all I really got for that. You want to knock out some questions and then we'll wrap up?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, we're making this a long one. 2 hours, 15 minutes is what I got. I got a little potty break in the middle. Hopefully we'll edit a couple minutes out.
It's okay, I got to beat Zap in terms of the runtime.
Okay, yeah. I'm just starting at the top. So James Dyer and I were texting. James Dyer runs a machine shop. He's a Toolpath customer, runs a machine shop down in Southern California called Accurate Dial and Nameplate. We did a customer video about them. I just love visiting machine shops, especially ones that have history. This place made if you're an aviation dork, I mean, they started making nameplates and dials and instrument gauge, you know, faces and all that stuff since the 50s. For like companies like Lockheed Martin and those companies.
Right.
So like some of the most iconic airplanes in the world, these guys made all the dials and nameplates, all like signs. It's so freaking rad. So he's building a machine shop to be part of their business, and it's fun to see him, you know, learn and grow, and they're doing some rad stuff. So I was texting him about some Toolpath stuff before this podcast. I was like, hey, give me some questions, because I know you have a connection with Dylan. He actually started by saying, man, Dylan's freaking awesome, or something along those lines. He said, you've answered a ton of questions for him. So he was clearly very appreciative of that. So he started with the softball. What's your favorite ice cream? Do you have
fish
a favorite
food?
Ice cream?
Ben and Jerry's ice? Fish food, I'd say.
What? Well, tell me about this. It sounds disgusting.
It's chocolate ice cream, marshmallow swirl, dark chocolate pieces.
Oh, I'm in.
I think that's about it. Yeah.
I'm in. Good. Okay. What do you feel is the right? When do you feel is the right time to buy another machine? If you can't guess, this is something he's thinking a lot about right now.
Right. I don't know. I feel like every time I've bought a machine, it's like in retrospect been too late.
Hmm.
I wish I'd always bought it 3 months earlier, 6 months earlier, or whatever. For me, it's again, it's all about that like calculated risk. Like I have to find the math that makes it comfortable for me. So like for our first machine, it was like, okay, everything hits the fan, Brad and I can afford it. And now it's like, okay, you know, if I buy this super expensive machine and I save this much money and I put this much down on it, I have this much runway that like if, you know, shit hit the fan, I've got to find new work in. And I'm pretty confident that like in the 8 month of runway that I've given myself, I can pivot pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
okay. I have to say, so I've been in the machining industry for a long time, 26 years this year. I've never had the balls to start a machine shop. I've had several.
You have one in your garage, though.
I have one in the garage. I have one in the garage. Yeah. I shoehorned a VF2SS in the garage, and I have anxiety. I have regular anxiety if I ever have to move in a hurry, because that machine had to get pulled apart to fit in there. Thanks for reminding me of that.
Yeah,
I felt like a coward a few times. Like, I've had a couple good opportunities, too. I was just always just trigger shy. So his other one was about time management. We talked about this a little bit, but he specifically was like for scheduling, time quoting, programming, talking to customers, doing office work. I think about this all the time. I was just at Dennis Rathy's shop, and man, the dude juggles a lot of stuff. Do you have a systematic way of dealing with it, or you literally just bang through it, or talk about that a little bit?
I would say automate what you can. Like, that's the biggest thing. Like, try to find systems that do the things that you do. And then, you know, try to hire somebody even part-time. Like, we're starting to use somebody to do our invoicing, and I'm training them up on that. And, like, it's not full-time. It's not, you know, it's more contractor basis stuff, but it's like that gets that off my plate. But really a lot of it is just, you know, being an expert firefighter at this point and just,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It might look calm and collected, but under the surface, it's just like constant things going around in my head of like, oh, I got to do this and this. And then like, I make a ton of lists, a ton of checklists. I put a ton of alarms in my phone all day, every day of like, do this, do this, do this. You sure you did that? You really need to do that today. Like the kind of stuff. And so
that's valuable. That's valuable. I at Toolpath, I feel like I'm just constantly have 100 things to do, enough time to do 40 of them almost well. So I have this constant, you know, to-do list that keeps getting reprioritized. So if I was going to say something to that, I think a lot of people look at, you know, our Insta friends or even our friend that we know and see his shop and feel like they got their shit together better than they do. I really do feel like the more I get to know people, the more I feel like we're all just banging around trying to figure it out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and we all do stuff well. Like, there's things that we all do better than others, and we can all learn from each other. But there's, I have yet to talk to anybody on my podcast where they're like, man, I got everything figured out, and I'm just chilling. Like,
CJ does.
yeah, that's true. He's probably the closest. Yeah, I think when he was on, he was like, oh, yeah, I'm at a 95% uptime. And I'm like, all right, dude, whatever.
Nobody likes you, CJ. Stop showing off. correction, people, CJ, it's hard to not like. I don't want to hurt his feelings. Okay, so I'll drill in on James. So he also, the last question for James, he actually gave me a bunch of funny ones I'll cut out for the sake of time, but how do you find customers? So this is like the customer hunt, right? Do you go looking for customers? We'll leave it with that.
Currently we don't, because we just don't have the capacity to add more customers. That's kind of another reason we're looking at, you know, adding automation, is that I need more capacity because I do want to diversify more. Like, we're not thankfully stuck on one big customer, but we have like a few big customers, and I would like to have a few more big customers and really, you know, be able to lose one or two and feel good.
Do you feel like you've found any like cheat code for finding decent customers?
Not really. Like, all of our biggest customers have come through word of mouth or friends of friends or the podcast. One of our big customers came through. Yeah. I would say like just putting yourself out there really is what it's about. Like it really is who you know in this industry. Like you will find somebody if you're just like at events and, you know, post a YouTube video or on Instagram or on LinkedIn. I know friends who have had success on all of those platforms finding customers.
Yeah. So have I. This is a question I ask a lot of people, especially a lot of the younger, newer shops are like, how do I find customers? And ask your network, like, how did you find your customers? And don't be scared to try new stuff. That's kind of my my two cents. From Instagram, Lone Wolf Precision. What are your? He's making some dirt bike parts, so that's probably why he's in my feed. what is your proudest moment in machining? If you can't pick one, pick three. Setup related, business related, stuff like that. Yeah, you'll answer. I'll see if anything pops up for me when you're answering, if you want.
Yeah, a few proud moments that I can pick out. One, we won, I don't remember what year, I think it was 2018, the Autodesk CAM competition for that gear mobile of all of the Autodesk logos. That was...
I forgot that was you.
Yeah, that was amazing. So that was, I was actually at my last day job. Working an inspection, and Brad texts me and goes, dude, go back and watch the live stream where they announced the winners. And I'm like, oh, like, do we come in last? Like, you know, do we even get a mention? And I'm watching it. And it was like, you know, they announced third place and second place. And I'm like, oh, man, we didn't even place. Like, this sucks. And then they announced us. And I was like, oh, my God, this is amazing. Yeah.
Dude, I forgot that was you. That was fun. I voted on that. That's even more fun.
I appreciate that.
That was on the Kitamura we had. People for that. Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah.
That's an interesting one real quick. All right. Well, I was going to tie that to Connor, right? So Sean, that video I just watched of Connor manufacturing, I don't know, a few days ago, he made this little Elon Musk, you know, 3D thing. And he was talking about, sometimes you just got to do stuff just because. I'm not making money from this. I'm not, you know, I'll learn some stuff. That'll be fun. What piques my interest is like, how do you justify that? I remember being at Autodesk when we were talking about, like, it's a bunch of us, like, we're all terrible at, like, talking each other out of doing work. Like, we don't have a good habit of talking. Al and I don't have a habit of talking each other out of doing less or into doing less, right?
Right.
And we're like, it'd be cool if we did a cam challenge. And then just this thing gets snowballed and snowballed and snowballed. And I remember, like, yeah. And then pausing to be like, wait, this is stupid. who's gonna shut their shop down to make something for this stupid cam challenge? And now we're talking about doing something similar for Toolpath because it was a rad thing. But like, how do you justify? You could apply the same thing to with intolerance, right? Like, how do you justify doing something that doesn't have a direct line to revenue?
So for us, like, the cam challenges. And this actually goes back to the first shop I was in. So at my first shop, my boss was completely fine with me after hours using any material on the remnant shelf any personal projects. He was like, as long as you clean up and you put the machine back how you want and or how it was and you're careful and don't crash anything, you can use any tool, you can use whatever, for it. And like, I learned so much quicker because of that, because I had a ton of personal projects. I was designing stuff all the time. And the same thing applies to the cam challenges. I would save up trying, you know, the new feature in Fusion. Like, oh, there's a new 3D toolpath. Well, I can't try that on a customer part that's due in 2 days. Like, I might screw it up, and I don't have time for that. I have zero extra time in my schedule right now. And so the cam challenges gave us a fantastic time to sit down, design something cool. It was just so fun. It never felt super competitive either. Like, I was always excited to see what other people came up with. And then on top of it, I got better. I learned better 3D surfacing. I learned better ways to edit models. I learned all this stuff. And like, that's how you grow, I think. I don't think you can grow by doing customer parts, but you can't be experimental and you can't take risks on customer parts that you can on, you know, oh no, I didn't get to submit my cam challenge. Like, okay, did you learn? Did you have fun? Okay. Mission accomplished. You're done.
So on Lone Wolf, you know, one of the things he's asking about is like setup related, right? That made me, one of the things I was thinking about was, that's one of the things I specialized in when I had my own business doing turnkey projects, was like doing work holding. And like most of us, when we program something today versus 5 years from now, like, we'd be embarrassed about what we did today. And like 5 years from now, we'll be like, oh, but next time I'm going to do this. And I was like racing back through all the work holding I've done or setups I've done, and they've just been this like evolution, right? And that's kind of your point with the customer thing. You have this risk versus reward. Like, I have to deliver on this thing. I can't fail. Sometimes when I knew like, oh, the timeline on this project is a little longer, I have some room to try this fixture and have it not work out. That to me is probably where I did a lot of my learning, right? Like, oh, I want to try this new toolpath. I'm going to use it on this fixture. Totally doesn't make any sense to do this fancy 3D toolpath on this fixture, but it'll give me a place to go try it, right?
Right.
So like the cam challenge, it's like easy to justify a little bit of that for growth. And I would encourage 100%. Anybody listening, like, just decide you're going to be good at it and go figure it out, right?
Yeah.
So
I'd say another proud moment was my first like one and done fairly complex part on the Hermla, like getting to do that, you know, you flick it and it vibrates and you snap it off. Like, it's just something I had seen on Instagram forever, and it took me a long time to get there to where I had a machine I could do that on. And man, that first one, and everything came out perfect. I could sand my tabs off and ship the part. I was like, oh, this is magical. Magic. Like, this is,
Do you have any, is there any recipes or, you know, without giving away all the secrets, any tips if I wanted to go do some tabbed workflow on my rotary? Make sure you do this.
One thing,
stagger your tabs or something like that.
Yeah, so I triangulate my tabs quite a bit. So I'll do two tabs on one face of the part and one on the other one. And I find that you can get, depending on the size of the part, but like we do fairly small stuff that, you know, fits in the palm of your hand. And like I can get tabs that are 2 or 3 thou thin and, you know, very easily deburr completely off. You get a surprising amount of rigidity that way. And then, you know, I still struggle, like 2 or 3 thou thin in aluminum breaks off easy, 2 or 3 thou in stainless. And you're like struggling to get that thing off. And you're like, man, where's the hacksaw? Like I screwed this thing up. But that's awesome. I would say that's like the biggest tip I have for that.
Cool. That works. All right. Business related. One of your more prouder business related moments.
I struggle with keeping perspective of where we've been. And I think that like on the rare occasion I'm reminded to, or have a second to take take a step back and be like,
yeah,
dude, in 10 years, you've built a business that you and your business partner can work at full time and get paid well and, you know, have benefits and all this stuff. Like that's, I think every day that I can take that step back is when I'm proudest. There's not like a specific, I never feel like, oh, I really got it over on my customer. Like I'm never going to feel proud about that and never have really had that. But every time I can step back and really think back and realize the magnitude of what we've accomplished through just consistency is pretty amazing.
That's rad. If I was sharing mine, I don't have anything that pops to mind right away. I think what we're doing at Toolpath makes me feel very special. Like we are, I was part of the early Fusion HSM Day people, and I feel like we did something pretty special there. I mean, we kind of changed the industry about how people look at CAM, and pretty proud of that. When I started on that team, there were 0 paid customers. And I mean, there's well over a couple 100,000 paid customers when I left. That's proud.
I wouldn't have a business without Fusion. So I owe it a lot to you guys.
That's what I was getting ready to talk about. Like that stuff's cool. But the amount of, you know, talking about how like social's changed our lives, like the amount of people that have like reached out to me, I've been like, dude, you did that video, changed my life. Like it sounds hyperbolic, but like I could also go back to my old mentors and say, hey, that time you showed me that thing, I mean, that kind of changed my life. So if I was, proud about something business wise, like I've had like an uncomfortable amount of people reach out to me and tell me some like, dude, you talked to me about this slitting saw and this thing instead of the way I was doing it. Like I just landed this job that changed my life. It's like, I try to squirm my way out of that compliment, but it's probably the thing I'm most proud of. So, all right. AC Hogs says, when is it time to find a new shop? I'll say both of them. He has 2 questions. When is it time to find a new shop and how So the next one is, how valuable is manual machining to an apprentice career? So that's 2 really separate questions. When we talked about it a little bit, when did you know you had to find a new shop?
I assume he's talking about finding a new job rather than a shop space. But
oh, damn. I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, let's take it that way because we already talked about your shop. Yeah. I took it the way you were talking about growing into a new shop. Yeah.
Right. Go. I mean, for me, it was like we were bursting at the seams. Like that was the shop thing for us. But as far as a new job, I don't know. Like I moved on when it was clear I could not continue to grow and learn somewhere. Like that was
nailed it.
It was so obvious to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll share the same with me. Like I for many years was embarrassed with how long my resume was. So I moved around a lot. I worked at my first job. I worked 72 hours at my first machining job. I worked like 72 hours a week, week after week, after week, after week. And I just learned a ton. When you work that much, you learn a ton. And then I just hit a wall. Like, okay, this is what the rest of my life looks like if I stay here. Like, all these people have gotten a divorce and had drinking problems. And, like, they just had this, like, uncomfortably repeatable, predictable life. And for me, it was about growth and learning new things. And, so that's it's the same thing for me. You know, if I felt like there was an opportunity somewhere else that I was almost maybe partially qualified for, I would go sign up for it and figure that out. And then I'll answer the next one and have you jump on top of that. So how valuable is manual machining to an apprentice's career? So it's less and less valuable from like a get a job, add value to the shop. This to me is like power grip holders. There's like hard to say there's not a ton of value in knowing how to be a manual machinist. But I don't think it helps a lot of people's like on paper, you know, jobs. If we had an abundance of time to train people, I would say everybody should learn how to be a manual machinist. Back in the day when you had more people that wanted to be machinists than jobs, I think it was a great filter to kind of filter out the people that weren't willing to stick out that stuff. As we have more positions that need to be filled and people to fill them, I'm kind of okay with schools not focusing on manual machining as like a requirement to become a machinist. What is your perspective? Because you learned manual machining in school, right?
Yeah, so I think I definitely agree with you that it's not like you're going to be – it's very rare to find a manual machinist job posting just in general. Mm-hmm. But I think it informs how you become a machinist. Like for me, I'm very much a person who like wants to learn foundational skills to build upon. And I think that like that's where it becomes very valuable. Like, oh, this is why climb milling is different. Like you can feel it in the table. And like this is – you learn how to like adjust spindle speed and feel where chatter is and things like that, that I don't think you inherently learn when you just jump into a CNC. And so I think it lays that foundation to build upon. But I think it should be approached in that way of like, hey, we're going to learn this. Whereas like when the program I went to, we spent 3 weeks on grinding drill bits and lathe tools. And I'm like, you know, maybe I'll use that if like things really go wrong and I got to get this job out. But like, you know, the likelihood of me grinding a high speed steel threading tool is like, you know, 1% or 0.1%.
Yeah. I also like learn foundational stuff. I like to learn why things work. I think there's ways for people to learn that stuff without having to go through a machining course, and be a competent manual machinist. I deeply dug into the history of why Americans are taught machining the way they've been taught for a long time. Like I was, before I could make a chip, I was handed this 3/8, you know, high speed steel lathe blank. I had to go make my own tool before I could make my own chip. And I don't think there's any bad lessons involved in that. The history of that is when we had to teach a whole crap ton of people how to build tanks and bombers and stuff for the war. They came up with basically a curriculum to teach to punch a machinist, heavy machinist, very, very, very fast. And our school system followed that, literally like followed the manuals. A lot of like the jack screws that we learned how to make back in machine school and stuff. A lot of those projects came from this old military training projects. The problem is, it's really interesting. Like, I've actually seen some of the manuals, like, oh my crap, I made that jack screw. Like, I followed that lesson. The high speed steel tool blank that you got, that's all like first day be a machinist stuff from the old military machining school. We've talked about this. I'm very passionate about the education and future of our industry. The problem is, I think when you make that a gate before people get to go do the next thing, I think you filter out a bunch of people that could be very, very, very productive machinists. Some of the best machinists I know have never touched a manual dial. So I think there's value there. I just don't think it should be a gate to getting into the industry.
Totally. Quick story actually about manual machining. So Brad and I were in the exact same manual machining class at Pima, and our final assignment was we made a parallel clamp. And so you milled it and surface ground the clamp bodies, and you made the screws and all that stuff. And then you were graded on how accurate it was. And he beat me by 1 point. Like, his was a 98 and mine was a 97. And he will never let me live that down till the day we die. Guaranteed.
As he like, should.
He brings it up maybe once a year. Yeah. He's like, well, I beat you in that class, though. Like,
beat you.
So,
I love it. I'm a borderline unhealthy competitive person. I get that very much. There's a whole series of projects in that military course about parallels, parallel clamps, all that stuff. So that all ties back to that. Our buddy Jim Belisic from Send Cut Send. He had, how has Within Tolerance podcast influenced the way you do business or run your shop?
Yeah. No, it definitely has. I mean, like I said, it has brought some business to us. I would say the biggest thing, though, is having that network of people and being, you know, if I need a opinion on some tooling brand or whatever, I reach out to a few people and I know that they've either had experience or they're going to send me down the right rabbit hole kind of thing. Yeah. It's really just built this, you know, digital Rolodex of people that I can turn to and lean on, and they can lean on me. And it just, I mean, this is kind of a through line, I guess, of this whole episode. Like, relationships are everything. And so, like, it's just killer. Yeah.
Yeah. His next question, I could maybe answer for you. Like, what's the best part of doing the podcast and what's the worst? So the best is probably the relationships. We've kind of answered that a couple times. It almost sounds like Jim's thinking about doing a podcast, which I would endorse. He's got a great personality. What's the worst part? Let's just cut to the what's the worst part.
It's probably the time it takes, you know, it's a hour to 2 hour commitment to record, another couple hours to edit. And then I listen to everything before it goes up. And so that's again, another couple hours and then maybe a little bit more editing and, you know, but again, I love to do it. It's just, it is time to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. That totally makes sense. I mean, that is the first thing I think about when our team's talking about doing one here. It's like, oh, what, if that, then what don't I do? Right. So, but I'll reinforce how important I think it's been for our industry. So good job.
Thank you.
So really neighbor of his, Phil Lynchide, up in Reno, I think they'll have some, he's got all kinds of cool stuff happening up there.
His episode comes out tomorrow, actually.
So. Yes. Okay. Did he share any fun news or just talking about what's happening up there? We'll find out.
Talking about what's happening currently.
Cool,
yeah.
Cool. Okay. So he's all jacked up on Mountain Dew. So he had a whole bunch of questions. So I narrowed it down to a few. This is a fun one. What's one feature infusion and or toolpath you want immediately? Let's start with toolpath. We haven't talked about toolpath enough.
Toolpath, I would love for it to have more fully fledged quoting. I would love to switch away from paperless today because the reason I use toolpath and paperless in conjunction is paperless's interrogation of the parts very often misses things. And so now when I've got like weird, we do a lot of weird parts that like, you know, we'll have broken surfaces that I might not see because it's like a tiny 5,000 sliver that has broken stuff and made it weird. They won't see it. I throw it in toolpath and it's like bright red. It's like, man, all this stuff is messed up. So
good.
Yeah.
For the listeners, Dylan probably has a little extra juice on functionality at toolpath because he's pretty good personal friends with Justin, our CTO. We are trying to balance that because right now we call it the estimator, right? Because it's helping you estimate what a part's going to take. Quoting is a different topic, right? It's still very much related, but it's more of a finish line. So we're juggling that with also getting, good toolpaths automation. So, that's a little update for everybody. All right. He also said, Phil also said, what is your favorite half inch in mill and why?
So we don't use many half inch. Half inch is really only for reach in my shop. 3/8 is kind of the go-to. Roughing in aluminum, Freza, AXFPS all day, every day. I've never found an end mill yet that can outperform that thing. Finishing, we use either Destiny or Freza.
Okay.
And then for stainless, their E-cut line, Chris and I have said it a million times, it's like the absolute best deal in tooling and stainless on the market as far as I'm considering. Yeah.
I've heard a lot of good things about that. If the question was also for me, my favorite is Swift Carb Ramp Mill for roughing. I would actually love to do a, you know, back-to-back with those. I think they're probably pretty similar.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think the ramp mill was the first end mill I got exposure to that had the really deep gash angles that allowed you to helix in at, you know, 12, 15 degrees, you know, helix angles in aluminum, like eight to 12 and steel, stainless and stuff. I got several finishing end mills I like. There's lots of good ones. You mentioned them. He also asked, what's the best and worst about podcast? So name one thing that you agree to disagree on the shop or in your processes. So let's make that specific. I'll start a little feud with you and Brad. is there any things that you're like, all right, we're just going to agree to disagree on this?
Not a lot, honestly. Yeah. Like we either talk through stuff or like one of us takes ownership and like that's just how it is.
Got it.
Yeah, I can't really think. I think like one thing that him and I do differently right now is that like I always use a rougher and a finisher for stainless and he just continues to like change his rougher finisher out quicker. All of our templates have the rougher and finisher in them because I made them.
Love it. Love it. Okay.
But yeah, we'll agree to disagree on that one.
Okay. If that was also directed at me, I'll use Al, our CTO at Toolpath. He and I actually have like pretty much nonstop, agree to disagree topics. today we announced, March promo to do a monthly subscription that'll lock you into a 12th of the annual subscription price. And because there will be about a 30% upcharge or whatever we'll call it moving forward after March. The agree to disagree is Al and I actually very much strongly agreed to disagree on when monthly should be offered. My position was that we kind of had to earn our way to a frictionless adoption, you know, before we opened it up for monthly, right? Because we would get my hypothesis, we'd get a higher churn if it was easy to get in, easy to get out. I guess I have to say he won. I was wanting to wait until knowing the roadmap, I was wanting to wait until probably May. Because right now with adoption, we just do it through Heroics. If people need support and help for anything that we don't do intuitively, we just help them. To be honest, to give a little credit to Paul Kloss on my team, Paul's doing a ton of heavy lifting to help help explain Toolpath to people. It's not a ton of heavy lifting. Toolpath is pretty good and easy to use, but there's a cut config that people have to kind of wrap their head around. And until we make that just really better as far as the user experience, mm-hmm. we'll see. We'll see how that churn is. I lost that one. It wasn't really a loss because I think it's, I agreed to do it as a promotion. Al and I have nonstop, but we find like pretty easy to agree to disagree on things and we respect each other's opinions and stuff. So that's a good one about Toolpath. What's that?
Not knowing that happened, I think I asked him a couple weeks ago or maybe a month ago when you guys were going to do monthly. Because like for me thinking about it, like back when I started Protium, like there's mm-hmm. no way that I would have jumped into a full year of anything. You know, Fusion was enough of a lift at like $300 a month or $300 a year. I mean,
year.
That's why I asked him as well. I was like, I think you'll get more small shops on board if they can just buy a month and find out. But I totally understand the churn aspect
it's
of it.
The churn
well.
Thing. Yeah. So the good news is literally hours, but not many, maybe a couple hours before we started this podcast. We sent out the, it became live yesterday and then we sent the email out today. We'll start socializing it on social in coming day or, oh, we started today. Anyways, we had quite a few subscriptions just popped in, that I was celebrating. And some of them had done the trial and waited. Yeah, it was great. It was great. I'm not going to say Al was right on that one yet, but, it probably wasn't wrong. we did Sean's, Dan Rudolph, power rank the machining podcast. We'll just skip that one.
they're all fantastic.
Yeah, that's a good answer. Okay. So we talked about Freddy's, and I think we're getting pretty close to wrap up. Did you get any on your end that we should address?
I didn't. No, I made sure to send people your way.
Cool. Dylan, this was a long one. My timer says almost 3 hours, so I could talk with you for quite a bit longer, I think. I can't express how much how important I think it is to the community for people to hear, you know, real genuine stories, people like you. Thank you for letting me share my story on your podcast. Thanks for taking the extra time to answer everybody's questions. You know what? Let's turn a little commercial on this one. We haven't talked much about Toolpath, and I don't want to turn it into a commercial, but I would love for you to share, before we fully wrap up, I would love for you to share your journey through Toolpath, how you use it now. Like, how did you first kind of catch wind of it? I think you've got a pretty decent, just full disclosure, I think you've found a pretty good relationship with Justin, but mm-hmm. I don't know how you guys even met.
I think we touched on it barely on his episode, but I still don't know. So he cold DM'd me on Instagram.
Okay.
And at that time he had, I think he was a private account. He had no profile picture and was just like, hey, I listened to the podcast, would love to show you this automation platform I'm working on, or something like that, like very vague.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately I was like, this has got to be some scam. Like, this is, you know, some BS account, doesn't even have a
That's
profile
amazing.
Picture.
Yeah.
I don't know what possessed me to respond and to continue talking to him, but he gave me, you know, some time. He gave me a link to like a Zoom or something,
Calendar
showed me
Zoom
what he had.
Yeah.
Was like, oh yeah, at that point he was like very dead set of like, oh, we're just going to like make the code in the cloud and you're just going to be able to post it to your machine and run it. Okay. And at that point, and Chris and I have talked about this too, because Chris has been involved in a lot of, failed maybe is the wrong word, but like automation things that have gone awry. And At that point, I was just like, this guy is so full of it. He's just another engineer who thinks he can come in here and solve this problem that we've been, you know, doing for 100 years and haven't figured out yet. But he was, there was something about it that was just like, he was very open to that kind of feedback of me being like, man, I really don't see this working how you think it's going to work. And like, nobody's going to trust this. I don't trust it. There's just like no way. And, you know, we kind of built that relationship, and every now and again, he'd show me the newest thing and like, oh, well, what do you think about this? And I remember one of the interactions I think that really kind of steered his mind of like, oh, we need to start kind of ground level of this, is he was like, oh, well, you know what? Maybe we'll just use this. You can use this to like run soft jaws through or something like that, and it'll be faster than you doing an infusion. I was like, let's do a Zoom really quick and I'll show you how fast it takes me. I was like, you send me a soft jaw that you want me to program.
Yeah.
And he sent me a fusion model. I brought it in, right click, applied my template that's all 3D tool paths, and it was done. And he was like, holy shit.
You got to beat
that. Like, yeah. I was like, I just don't see you beating that. And but that's really what struck me throughout the entire interaction with Toolpath from the very beginning, is that he wasn't so hard-headed about anything that he was just like, nah, you're wrong. Other people will like it. He really takes feedback to heart and really wants to do the best job. And you know, he's the only person that I've seen in this industry, like in the automation stuff, that like not only bought a machine, but tried to make customer parts and realized how hard it was and kind of realized like all the other things that you guys could do to make this right and to make it work really well for the community. And it's been great to see.
Good. Good.
Yeah. My journey, you know, was basically where I was sold was the first time I talked to, actually it was both Andy and Justin, the two co-founders. And they said they started with the mission of like, respect the complexity of the problem, is what both of them said separately. I remember I actually got goosebumps because I had used two other automated CAM tools. I don't need to even mention them, but and they were just a very not good experience for me. And I just remember if anybody doesn't know who Carl Bass is, he was the CEO of Autodesk when I was starting at Autodesk, and I was like his little pet friend because I was the machinist guy, and he's the one that got Autodesk into machining. And I remember he said some things that felt very belittling. Not actually, he might have been intentional. He does most things intentional. But he was like, it's just algorithms, Tim. And he said it very, felt belittling. And in hindsight, it wasn't meant to be. But he was, you know, he was trying to poke me into like, think about the problem. Like, it is just algorithms, right? I think the just part put me on my defense so much. But
right.
When Andy and Justin were like, well, first thing was we had to realize and respect the complexity of the problem. I got goosebumps because I had heard people like Carl. Carl is one of my favorite people, just for the record, but come at it from like, yeah, it's just algorithms. It's just, you know, templates. It's just, and I was like, nah, man, this making parts is hard. It's only 1,000 things I have to think about. Some of them I'm consciously thinking about, some of them I'm not. But and then when I tested Toolpath, I was like, oh, it's far, far from done. But man, it is think about things more like I think about things. So that's why I got excited about it. And then now, so you supplement your quoting with Toolpath to what I was hearing earlier was to like basically double check the geometry and tool matching and stuff like that.
Yeah. I think it has the best interrogation I've used on any platform. Like it will find the weirdest little geometry and flag it in a way that's usable. Like paperless is tool, like has all these warnings, but again, it's so many that sometimes you just are blind to any of the ones that actually matter. The coloring of the model and tool path and things like that really mean that, oh, I can see what's going on, and I can see that surface is drafted by like 0.5 of a degree that I didn't know.
Yeah.
Cool. All right.
Yeah. Before I accepted the job at Toolpath, I did like a side job in my garage on my Haas during like one of the Autodesk winter breaks. And basically accepted the job. It had just crap tons of pockets. I mean, I had hours into just finding which Harvey tools would fit into these stupid, you know, 8x diameter corners and 3x diameter corners. And it was like they didn't have the same damn fillet on any of these pockets. And it was a super expensive big copper plate. And it had to be done between the time that this company was closed and by the 2nd of January. I was like, perfect. This is when I'm sitting on my ass at home. I might have been injured.
Right.
So I wasn't riding my dirt bike or anything. And long story short, my buddy was like, this can't be late. Like real serious. Like I'm burning up some juice to pay you a bunch of money to make this part.
Right.
And then during the holiday, I found it was like a 26th thou hole in the end of this, you know, 28 inch plate.
Oh no.
I don't know if you're familiar with the stroke, you know, the Z travel on a VF2.
Yeah.
It's not 26 inches. I ain't got it. And it was like, had to be more accurate than I'm going to pop with a drill or whatever. And I just was like, I just screwed my friend. So anyways, the first thing I did before I accepted the job at Toolpath was ran it through Toolpath. And it was like, first thing I noticed was like, all right, didn't miss that hole. And it identified all of these internal corners and helped me figure out what tools I need for them.
Yeah.
It's like, man, what a freaking tool. So it's been fun for me. I'm at eight months at Toolpath.
And has it been that long already?
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. It might be nine. It might be nine now, but yeah. Just to see how much we've grown in that amount of time. I went from like going into IMTS, like having real serious talks with everybody at Toolpath. Like we can't be telling people to go out and try CAM because we're just not matured enough in that space. And we want to be the credible people. Right.
Right.
Well, it was a couple weeks ago. I think I mentioned it on my last podcast, like I made my first 100% part in my garage that I was stoked with how it programmed the part with my tools. And that was a huge milestone for me. And then I realized like, oh, we've stuck with the same messaging while the CAM has gotten better and better. Right. So now we've transitioned to like, go out and bang on it, try it, you know, give us feedback. We're still not saying it's solving everybody's problems. It's not programming better than Dylan's going to program. But I think Paul was just telling me a whole list of customers, like these guys are all using it to kind of get a jump start on where they're going to start. So it's been super fun for me. I just wanted to talk about how you're using it. See, in a very authentic way, like I want to understand how you're using it, what value you're getting out of it. So thanks for sharing that.
Oh, of course. Oh, one other real quick story.
Yeah.
Speaking of how far you've grown, it was very funny. Justin, I was like, you let me know when you want to come on the podcast, like very early on, because I thought it was really cool. And I think he's such an interesting person and so smart that I wanted to have an episode. And he was like, when we get 5 paying customers, I'll come on the podcast.
Yes.
And like, that was the benchmark. And
I didn't know that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That was his benchmark. It was like, I want to get 5 paying customers and now it's awesome. Blown up, you know?
Now so it was, up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's never fast enough, but, it's pretty impressive. Someone at Autodesk said back in December, and they're like, how many customers you have? And we're not super public about it, but I was like, and he's like, OG Fusion guy. And he's like, dude, that's more than Fusion had at this point in their, at this point in their life. And I was like, holy
shit. That's amazing.
Yeah. Hopefully it keeps on that growth, but it's been super fun. Thanks for the support with Toolpath and with doing this podcast and everything you do for the community, Dylan. It's you're a huge part of the community. It's been fun to know you.
Thanks so much.
I don't think we have to do any fancy wrap up more than that. Yeah. Sorry, I talked over you for the 100th time. What were you saying?
No. I was just saying it's my pleasure and you know, it's an honor to be on another podcast. It is a little weird to be on the other side of it. So
that was
so
the
much.
Plan. Flip the script on Dylan. Cool. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for joining. Ben, we made it over 3 hours. He's our editor, so have fun editing that. I don't think we cursed as much as Zap and I did, so hopefully we'll have to deal with that. But thanks for joining, everybody. Subscribe, do whatever the other fun stuff is, and we'll talk to you the next time. Bye.